Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
This is Matt Demmer of Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury here to tell you about the exciting new Lincoln Mercury lineup. With the all-new Lincoln MKX, available all-wheel drive MKZ, or the newly designed Lincoln Navigator or Mercury Mariner, we have something for everyone. Stop in and see today. Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury on Michigan Avenue in Dearborn.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Well, thank you very much, and welcome to the broadcast. Another Sunday night, broadcasting from Detroit on WRIF. Welcome to all our radio listeners and to those of you listening on our internet stream across the country and across the world. Joining me, Jalene Jordan. Hi, Jalene.
Hello, Peter. Good evening.
You know, this could all end, this internet streaming stuff.
You know, this is really sad, that the possibility of it.
I should,
explain what's going on.
Oh, you're
going
to ask me to do that, aren't you?
Well, it's not our company shutting it down.
No.
And it has to do with royalties.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the music is getting played, and usually you get a royalty when every song gets, you know, maybe, is it like 7 cents or something every time it gets played on the radio, and on rated stations anyway. And so now they are wanting royalties from internet streaming, and that will cost so much money for radio corporations to be able to do.
Well, WRIF wouldn't be cost effective.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, they could keep streaming talk radio, but since WRIF is overwhelmingly about 99% a music station, they would just, it's the day the music died, that old classic rock tune. But if you go to savenetradio.org, you'll get all the information. But here it says, breaking news, internet radio breathes sigh of relief. Congress and Sound Exchange hear outcry of webcasters. And listeners temporarily agree not to force webcaster showdown. Of course, it would have been nice if I would have read this prior so I could...
Hey, but you came up with the info.
Yeah, well, I'm kind of going to it real. This is from Wired Magazine. Sound Exchange is the group responsible for collecting music broadcasting royalties, and they confirmed it has proposed new terms for internet radio that could lower fees for some webcaster.
Mm.
Well, the deal is, if everybody stops streaming music, they're not going to be able to turn over any royalties. I mean, it's understandable. If we're streaming music, the artist should get some payment for it. There's other stuff does through BMI and
ASCAP. You knew this was going to come up.
Well, yeah.
As time went on.
What they want is absolutely insane. Mm-hmm. I mean, they will have, instead of more income, they'll have like zero income because everyone's going to stop.
Streaming live.
Yeah.
There are a lot of stations that don't stream live currently, just because I think it costs money to begin with. But this company does stream live, and we're fortunate that they do.
And that's, so we are able to get this program and WRIF music all across the world.
Got it. And people listen from all over the world to this program, and when I'm on the air, and when everyone else is on the air, all over the world, and I get calls from, it's amazing. Finland,
sure.
Hello.
Well, yeah, we do have a listener base in Finland,
yes.
Don't we? That's for streaming internationally and around the country. But Jalene and I are going to be hosting a film this coming Thursday night right here in our hometown of Detroit. It's interesting. It's not actually in the city of Detroit.
Metro Detroit,
yeah, in Royal Oak. Now, here's the deal. We'd like to invite everyone listening to a special preview showing of the documentary called No End in Sight. It's a new film, and rather than chronicling all the lies that got the United States into the war in Iraq, it's about, well, it says here, it's a jaw-dropping insider Fender's tale of wholesale incompetence, recklessness, and venality. I like that word.
Ooh.
This was written by a Catholic. They're into venal venality. Yeah, if you're listening, Shane. But it's the people that have. That are responsible for the mess that we're in. Now, you say, oh, I know that. Well, there's enough in here that I didn't know, and there's enough in there that you may not as well. But there's another aspect to this viewing of this film. It's going to be Thursday, July 19th, 7:30 p.m. This Thursday at the Main Art Theater. And what it does, it's going to bring us together. It's going to first just bring us together as viewers, and then after, Jolene and I are going to be moderating a discussion after the film. But adding even more so to that, there's going to be all sorts of anti-war groups that are going to have their material there, acquaint you with what they have coming up, and there's all sorts
fabulous.
Of it. Yeah. So first and foremost, I was trying to think, I don't know if we have to make a list or, you know, rank it, but it's bringing us together physically. It's
as not, like-minded people, yeah, and people with a passion against this war.
Absolutely. And we're not, it's not on the internet. It's, I mean, we're going to be in the same room together.
What a concept.
Oh, wow. I don't know.
Can
I
modern concept.
Yeah. All right. But here's the best way. You can, I don't know. They may hate me for this, but I'm going to say you can just show up. But the best way is to...
Because it's free.
Yeah, it's free. To go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com. And the first thing up on the site, it will show you how to get passive. It'll take you to the website. You print that out and...
Come on out.
Yeah, you know, also, you can come here to WRIF. Not now, though, because we don't... Even if we could give them to you, we can't even, you know, the gates and the security and the barbed wire and the...
Right.
Everything else. But if you come during the day, like if you've won a prize, there'll be some of these passes sitting up at the front desk. Or if you just, I don't know, you're in the neighborhood, just come by and grab one. We're right across from Ryan's Junkyard.
And on the corner is Charlie's Auto Repair.
Yeah. Which is Charlie's Auto Repair. What did I think? Car. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. C-A-R.
Oh.
They figured that out.
Wow. But you've driven here too many years, Peter.
Well, I played the big softball game.
It was the Detroit Riders against the Detroit Artists?
Yeah, okay. Writers.
Writers.
Sounds like you said Riders.
Writers. I'm sorry.
Yeah. We got our ass kicked.
You did?
Yeah. I can't believe it.
How did you do?
9-2. I went, well, what we did.
Are you any good at softball, Peter?
Well, I'm playing the
long... an athletic kind of guy.
Well, I haven't played in a long time. I did okay. No fielding errors.
Really?
And what we did, we had this roster that of about, I think about 15 or 16 people, and everybody got to bat, whether you're in the field or not, so we didn't get to bat that much. So I was batting 500.
Oh, nice.
But we were doing terrible. We even had
I think that's good.
We even had these guys that get hit pretty well. And for the first, like, three innings, no one hit a ball out of the infield. So, you know, there's this famous deal where Babe Ruth pointed to the grandstands where he was going to hit a home run and then hit it right in there. So I pointed, and they kind of looked at me. I said, I'm hitting this one out of the infield. And so I took a mighty swing, and it went out of the infield about a foot. I mean, it was a ground ball, but ran it out. I actually beat the throw to first base.
Great.
And actually, my wife said she'd never seen me run that fast.
And you've been together a long time.
Yeah.
That's saying a lot.
She said, wow. But it was a great game. Danny McLain. Yeah, he's out. Do you know who Danny McLain is?
He was an athlete.
Well, he was an athlete indeed. He was
here in Detroit.
1968 the Tigers, the World Championship.
At least I knew that much.
A pitcher. He was the last major leaguer to win 30 games, and so he threw out the first pitch. It was all sponsored by the Detroit Artist Market. You can go to thedetroitartistmarket.com. I think it's .com. And catching for him was Eli Zaret, you know, who announces at the Pistons game.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, used to work here at WRIF. So that was that.
Good for
I don't
you.
Know. But I think they had these ringers. I mean, there were guys on their teams that had spikes. Guys playing with spikes. Yeah, we had people from the Metro Times that, I'm sorry, that were actually, never mind.
Wearing Birkenstocks?
No, I shouldn't. I shouldn't talk about them. But the other hit of the week was I saw Bob Dylan on Wednesday.
Yeah, you've been all over the place.
Yeah. So we're there, and some of the people from the station said, boy, his voice was a little rough, Dylan. And I said,
it's always been rough.
Well, I would say he'd be happy if his voice was a little rough. It was gone. My wife said, can you understand what he's saying?
But she said she was moved by it.
Oh, yeah, it was an incredible concert. But if someone was, that.
Well,
I don't.
Aren't we used to that by now? Don't we all know that?
It's going downhill.
It's going downhill quicker.
All right, let's get to business. Here's what's not news. I heard a couple of newscasts yesterday that led with the death of Lady Bird Johnson. This was the big story.
Everyone in their wildflowers. I watch CNN. I sleep with it. Sleep CNN on every night.
You're sick.
All night long. I do.
Yeah.
And so I hear little things sometimes when I wake up, and I have three dogs, so sometimes they wake me up, and I'll see these accounts. So constantly.
Why is that news?
Well, I mean, first lady passed away. They always make a big deal out of that, Peter. You know that. Look at that. Oh, my God. She loved nature. Come on now.
Yeah.
She loved the flowers and the birds.
All right.
Just like you and I.
Let's get down to it. We're going to have to intertwine
here
the economy, Iraq, and something else. Where was it? Oh, yeah, Republican hypocrisy.
You didn't tell me that I had to work that hard tonight. You know what? It's not tough to do, right?
No, it's not at all. Although, I don't know. This is probably too much here. Look at how many stories I got about the economy. Well, here, tell me if this, this is probably out of nowhere. And I don't even know why I started reading this article. It's in the New York Times today. And it says, the tax man hits in the guise of a traffic cop. Short of cash.
Cash.
Thank you.
Money.
Short of cash and long of arm, the state of Virginia recently unveiled the nation's first $1,000 speeding ticket. The money will be spent on maintaining roads and bridges, safety improvements, and closing a $500 million gap that emerged in last year's transportation budget. And they also then begin to talk about all these other states that are leasing bridges in Kentucky, taxing tattoo parlors in Arkansas, selling off large chunks of the state highway system in Indiana, selling off bundles of state student loan portfolios in Missouri, taxing funeral processions in New Orleans.
What?
Yeah, I don't know. But, and we know what's happening.
I think this, to me, in real simple terms, says that this country's going to hell in a handbasket.
Yeah, and look at the state of Michigan. Constitutionally, the governor is required to balance the budget. He can't do it like Bush has done and driven. She can't drive the state into debt the way Bush has driven the country into debt. So what has to happen is all these services have to be cut. Now, what is happening in the richest country in the world? Well, there's been two things, really. There's been this this massive redistribution of wealth. And that has been all to the to the wealthy, the ultra wealthy, through a series of different devices, taxes. The war provides tax dollars instead of to help the people of the United States. It enriches these corporations, and that is the other part of it, the military-industrial complex. And that has kind of gotten to be almost a cliche. Yeah, that you say military-industrial complex, and you kind of think of Halliburton. And
you kind of gloss over him.
Yeah, but it is so deeply rooted to the extent that it defines the economy of the United States. The United States economy, they always say, no, it's a service economy. It's not a manufacturing economy. Well, it does a lot of manufacturing, and increasingly, it's a large percentage of it is preparation for war because we have these enemies with these enormous armies and these high-tech armed forces. Oh, no, I guess we don't, do we? We've got, as I always say, barefoot guys with Kalashnikovs that can set bombs or take off and hijack planes, which hopefully they have a handle on. Well, here's where a lot of the money's going. This is another article in today's paper in the New York Times. The richest of the rich, proud of a new Gilded Age. Now, the Gilded Age was the 1880s, 1890s, up to about World War I, where these ultra-wealthy men Rockefeller and Carnegie and a whole host of them that are the names that we always think of as being Andrew Mellon, people like that were the great industrial innovators of the 19th century. Well, the other name for them, of course, they talk in this article about them being the barons. What they really called them were the robber barons,
mm-hmm.
because they enforced this extreme extraction of wealth from the labor of the workers of this country. They were able to assemble this enormous fortune, by monopolistic methods, but that meant working workers 12 and 14 hours a day, child labor, no safety, on and on. So it was the maximization of profit, and it came out of the hides of our great-great-great-grandfathers and grandmothers, and some of them when they were children. Life expectancy of people during the 19th century in general industrialized world, particularly England and the United States, plummeted because of the harsh working conditions. This is how these guys made their money, and also through cutthroat business practices. They had a chart of all the wealthy men of the United States, and in today's dollars, I forgot what they had. Mr. Microsoft, Bill Gates.
Mm-hmm.
They had, he's like $52 billion. John D. Rockefeller, the first one who owned all the oil in the United States, $182 billion. $182 billion was his net worth but he was a philanthropist. He would give out dimes on the street.
No.
Yeah.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Oh.
He would give out that.
What a rat.
So here, this is what the Times says. Those earlier barons, I call them the robber barons, disappeared by the 1920s, and constrained by the Depression and by greater government oversight and high income tax rates that followed, and no one took their places. Then, starting in the late 1970s, as the constraints receded, and what that means is laws were passed. See, they have this language because the New York Times, I mean, they say, this liberal newspaper, it speaks for big finance capital. It speaks for the ultra wealthy. But they're not insane like these people, these wealthy people that Bush represents. They understand that you have to have a long view of things. We've been here a long time being
like the
rich.
The Washington Times. They're not like...
Oh, yeah, yeah, exactly, which is a right-wing paper owned by
the Moonies.
Owned by the Moonies and operates at tens of millions of dollars of losses that is subsidized by this right-wing religious fanatic, Sun Yat-sen.
Yes.
Moon. Yeah.
And Bush kind of digs that paper.
Oh, yeah, that's one of his favorite papers.
He doesn't read the paper. If he read one, it would be that one.
Yeah. Well, new tycoons gradually emerged during the 70s, and now their concentrated wealth has made the early years of the 21st century truly another gilded age. And that was because they, these robber barons of the 19th century built these enormous mansions, and they had all this stuff of the... that could be bought then. Only twice before over the last century has 5% of the national income gone to families in the upper 1/100th of a percent of the income distribution. 15,000 families now in the... So that's, would say four people a family, although it's probably extended family. So it's, 50,000 people then control 5% of the total wealth of the United States. Such concentration at the very top occurred in 1915 and 1916, but now it's back. And they're talking about this guy, Sanford Weill, who's the president of Citigroup. His net worth exceeds $1 billion, not counting the $500 million he says he's already given away. Okay, so you got that. That's where the money is going. Also, this is interesting. A guy went to high school, Josh Saslov, he's a realtor. He's representing a house that's going for $135 million.
Whoa.
Yeah, the most expensive.
Where?
Aspen, California.
Aspen, Colorado?
Colorado, thank you. One of those nights. Okay, so here's what's going on. Well, let's do a few more things here. Bush is going to veto this bill that would extend childhood health insurance. The White House said Saturday that Bush would veto a bipartisan plan, the Republicans are on board for this, to expand the Children's Health Insurance Program drafted over the last 6 months by bipartisan senior members of the Senate Finance Committee. The vow puts Bush at odds with the Democratic majority in Congress, with a substantial number of Republican lawmakers and with governors of both parties who want to expand the popular program to cover some of the nation's 8 million uninsured children.
And these are the poor children, and he doesn't give one you-know-what about them. You know, isn't
Rats
he
booty.
Just a sweetheart? Yeah. He is just a real winner.
So he's going to veto it, and it right now insures about 7.5 million people. And since it's the Children's Health Insurance Program, may do all children, or maybe mothers in there as well. The proposal would increase current levels of spending by $35 billion over the next 5 years, bringing the total to $60 billion. Well, he probably figures that since the country's already in debt, that's part of their game plan, is to run us into debt and then say that these social programs cannot be financed by the government.
Oh, sure.
That they have to, if any, see, they're frightened. This spokesman says this will have the effect of encouraging many to drop private coverage to go on to government-subsidized programs. You fool, they don't have any. These are children with no coverage whatsoever.
That's sad.
And part of it's the tax structure. People say, well, they earn their money. Well, Warren Buffett, who's, what, the second wealthiest guy in the country, I think, he pointed out that he pays an average federal income tax of 17.7%, while his receptionist pays about 30%. So that's how the tax structure.
Did I read somewhere that he's thinking about running for president?
I doubt it. Maybe.
I thought I
Who knows?
Something about that.
More. I mean, it's endless. The Blackstone Group, the big buyout firm, has devised a way for its partners to effectively avoid paying taxes on $3.7 billion, the bulk of what it raised last month from selling shares to the public. Although they will initially pay $500 million in taxes, the partners will get that back and then some. And they'll get another $200 million more from the government over the long term. And the government, remember, I don't know. I mean... And who is it? It's like you and me. The $200 million will go to these ultra rich 100. What is it? The 0.1% or something like that.
Yeah, that's what it
is. All right. So here's the deal. We can continue with this class warfare that redistributes the wealth of this country, the commonwealth, right? That we all produce at one level or another. And continue to give it to the ultra-wealthy people that don't do anything with it. You can't do anything with $1 billion, let alone if you got $52 billion. And if you give it all away, so they're going to say, we're going to give it all away. Well, then this is really the peasantry, because then we have the barons who, through their generosity and their sense of social obligation, give alms to the poor. That's us.
They'll give money to so they can have buildings in their name and you know things where their name can always be remembered because their egos are so huge.
Well,
along with their pocketbooks.
We know now that how much was this? Something like $12 billion a month for our
the war,
not for our
for the
war
in Iraq.
Yeah.
Well,
when I read that,
I was completely astounded. You know, I just always need to be reminded of those numbers. $12 billion a month it's costing us.
Well, here's two things we could do to get things back together. First and foremost, cut the war budget completely so we're not spending anything on this war. And the second thing is tax the rich. You know, you could do something like after $10 million, you have a 90% tax on income. You know, that would work.
Yeah, well, it would work, but just think how impossible that really is.
Well, I don't know. I mean, why would even the wealthy object to that? I mean, if somebody said all you're going to have is $10 million a year income.
They would, though. You know.
Yeah. Instead of hundreds of billions. Well, I was thinking, and we were talking about this last week, about what we could finance. Health insurance for everybody.
Yes.
We'd get rid of all the private.
Bring it on.
All the private insurers. Make the people that work there get honest jobs, like working in the government health program. All right?
Yeah, sure.
Free college tuition. You know, I was talking to somebody, a neighbor of mine, who's really struggling and going back to college in her 30s. And you know, she says, the textbooks are $95.
Yeah.
And they're 210 pages.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, why? I mean, if I said we're going to have to pay for high school, you'd think I was crazy. But why should we have to pay for college if it's important to the nation? Right? I mean, you shouldn't have the government buying people iPhones, right?
Right, sure.
Yeah, or drinks or it's stuff like that, consumer items. But things that we all need as a nation and as a people. I mean, one of the things that would happen is that this would all get sorted out and we would have available to us the stuff that would make us a national community. rather than at each other's throats. And, you know, they're getting too much, and they're getting too much because they're this, and, you know, they're taking away our what have you. I mean, we're scrambling around at the bottom of the pile for these crumbs, where these people that are making $1 billion, they're thinking, should I give a library $20 million?
Right. You know?
Take their damn money, take 90% of their damn money, and build libraries everywhere. I mean, that's what...
Public libraries.
Free utilities for everyone. Well, I mean, you could say maybe if you're making over $100,000, you got to pay something. But why not? You know, even there's not that many people over $100,000 even, let alone in the millions. Thousands of people inside the city of Detroit have had their water shut off. Because for non-payment.
And it's still off. And it remains off.
Yeah.
They have no running water. Yeah. What century is this? What country is this?
So Mr. Weil has $1 billion, and just recently 6,000 families in Detroit had their water cut off. Free water for everyone. Free electricity for everyone. Why not? Free gas. And how that's paid for is by, because we wouldn't have to raise taxes at all, except on the ultra wealthy who could afford it and would not notice a bit of difference in their lifestyle. Because I know some of you middle class and working class people think, well, it's their money, you know.
They provide the jobs.
Yeah, they provide the job. Good, we'll give them $10 million.
If we vote Republican, then they'll continue to make the money, and then we'll get the money surely, right? No.
Mass transit. Why isn't there free mass transit?
Oh, well, I'd even go for mass transit here in Motor City.
Free postage. Was I saying that last week?
Oh, you're really going crazy now, Peter.
We could afford all of this, people, because think about all that you pay at the pump. Subsidized gasoline. I mean, if we're going to get ripped off by OPEC or the local oil companies, at a minimum, why not? Why doesn't the government subsidize the gas, or gasoline, the way they do in lots of other countries, so that we're paying like $1.50? And you know, it's being middle class. It hasn't stopped me. I mean, it POs me that I got to pay that. I know where it's all going. But man, if you're making $20,000 a year, and all of a sudden it's $3.50 a gallon, that's hurting you
big time.
Yeah. So people that are making $20,000 a year should not have to pay $3.50 a gallon. You could say, well, we could do an income, what they call a means check, right? Figure, well, if you make $75,000, your gasoline is $3.20, and if you make $100,000, it's $4. I mean, that's crazy. Give it away to everybody. I mean, we have the money here, the hundreds of billions of dollars that are going down the rat hole of preparation for war, of making this a military-industrial complex. Not making it. It is. Sustaining it as a military-industrial complex is a total waste. You say, well, there's jobs and there's return on investment for the people that got money in it. It is capital-intensive instead of labor-intensive, so it does not provide very many jobs for the buck if it was going into the creation of homes and roads and ferry systems across the Great Lakes and the clean the environment and on and on, and the money's all there. It's all there now. Plus, if you took money from the wealthy that and left them, again, folks, this ain't a real commies don't want to leave the wealth with $10 million, right? It'd all be there, and to the point where then, how about this? You can think, it's their money. How about this?
They earned it.
$50,000 tax deduction.
There you go again.
Yeah, $50,000 tax deduction. So that's right off the top. You make $54,000, you pay on $4,000. This all is affordable, but not if we live in a military-industrial complex. What about Al-Qaeda? What about Venezuela? What about Russia? What about China?
North Korea.
No, now they're our buddies. They're the ones.
Oh, wait, that's right. Yeah. How could I forget?
Yeah, we bought them off. They had nuclear weapons. Yeah. Saddam didn't. They threatened us. Saddam didn't. And now we've just, kind of bought them off. But we've got to make peace in the world. But if you're running a military-industrial complex, you don't want peace in the world, because if you have peace in the world, you can't run a military-industrial complex. You cannot justify $500 billion a year on military expenditures.
And all of those people, they can't fathom not having those, you know.
Yeah, well, they hate us, right? Well, yeah, and I don't think you can just say, okay, we're having no military budget and we're taking down we're all fired and we're taking down all our defenses. No, I mean, the pattern of U.S. foreign policy over the last 100 years has created the situation that's a justification for this. So we have to begin to unravel this. We have to begin to, how do we make peace? How do we stop the nuclear arms race that Bush has reinitiated? I mean, as it is, Russia has now suspended the arms agreement because the U.S. has entered Europe. Can you imagine if Russia was putting up some military facility in Canada or Mexico?
You know, when there was no problem.
Yeah, there was no problem. Yeah.
There was no threat from them.
Yeah. So now there's a nuclear arms race. Rather than trying to figure out a situation to disarm the world of nuclear weapons, Bush is rearming it. Why? Because there's billions to be made by his buddies, and they know suckers like us will keep paying the freight, because that's where it comes from.
How much longer? What is the time frame we have here? What are those bumper stickers we keep seeing?
Which
one?
1-9-0-9.
Right, 20. It's, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
January 20th.
That's almost unbearable.
2009
it's too far away.
Bush is out of there.
It's too far away,
yeah,
Peter.
It is.
It's just.
Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan. We're at 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Why couldn't we do all this? I mean, even if you have great sympathy for the ultra wealthy, why the hell would they have no sympathy for you? Let me tell you, they laugh at you. Those of you that defend their class interests laugh at you. They think you're a fool.
Got them. We got
you by the cojones.
Yeah, we convinced these people that they need us.
What's the flaw in here? Why couldn't we create what we need in this country and in the world? Why couldn't we use the trillions of dollars of wealth that exist instead of for war and concentration in the hands of a couple thousand men across the world, get rid of war, get rid of disease, stop the half the world living in slums, all of that. I didn't even talk about some of this.
And you know what? You didn't even mention, like, peace signs and flowers. You know how that criticism?
Yeah.
You have all your ideals, and someone said to me, you know, Peter Werby thinks that all you have to do is throw a bunch of flowers around, throw out a bunch of peace signs, and everything's going to be okay. It's like, okay, did you just hear what Peter just went through?
It's a program.
You just laid it all out, and you didn't say anything about flowers or peace signs.
Well, I got my lava lamp here, sitting right here on the...
You do.
Yeah. All right.
Groovy, baby.
Call TalkYes at yahoo.com for the shy or people that like to write. Call TalkYes at yahoo.com. And you can also go to myspace.com/nightcalldetroit. Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. What's going on here? All right. We'll be right back.
You're listening to WRIF.com. RiffsRadio.com. Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, Ann. Welcome back. Jalene Jordan, welcome back to you as well. 313-298-WRIF, talking about a little Robin Hood economics here.
I like that.
Very
much.
And everybody loved Robin Hood. He would steal from the rich and give to the poor. Well, in a way, as we're talking about here as well, solving our problems by ending the military-industrial complex, utilizing the money for social needs here and around the world, doing this redistribution on an equitable basis rather than on the basis it's taking place now where it's there's redistribution, there's class war, and we're losing our ass.
You can say that again, Brother Werby.
I'm glad, speaking that, let's welcome Ralph Valdez. Ralph Valdez is working with an incredible effort that happens every year. It's a Concert of Colors. It's a free festival that happens. Ralph Valdez, welcome to the Night Call Show.
Thank you. Thank you, Peter. Nice to be with you.
Yeah, and I'm glad you got through because I guess that other number didn't work, and I'm so anxious for people to hear about this because it's when our whole community comes together as a Concert of Colors. But tell us about the event and what's going on for people that may not know about it.
Well, the Concert of Colors is in its 15th year. It, for many years, was over at Shane Park on the Detroit Riverfront. And in the last couple of years, we've partnered with the Max M. Fisher Music Center, the home of the DSO. And we try to create kind of the best of both worlds, the indoor and the outdoor. We have outdoor stages and indoor stages. And it's a real celebration of music from around the world. It's a diversity festival is what we call it. There is also a very strong support for local music as well. But we have artists this year coming up beginning this Thursday and running through Saturday, like Hugh Masekela from Africa, the Neville Brothers, of course, from New Orleans, Steel Pulse doing great reggae music and based in England. We have Eddie Palmieri in a salsa band, a group called They Might Be Giants, known for many quirky and indie rock hits of that they have. We have folk artists like Tishina Hosa and Thomas Mapfumo, also from Africa. And
Katie Curtis. You have Katie Curtis.
And we also have Katie Curtis.
Love her.
She has got a great following. And locally, we have folks like Black Bottom Collective, The Paybacks, a great rock and roll group, of course, and then a great reggae group called The Basics. And Question Mark and the Mysterians will be joining us as well. So it's going to be a lot of fun. And it's all free. It begins this Thursday with one performance by the DSO. You get to see them perform.
Detroit Symphony Orchestra, right.
Yeah, and it's a chance to see the DSO perform for free on Thursday, the 19th of July. But then the festival really kicks in on Friday, Saturday and Sunday with all-day performances beginning around 5 o'clock on Friday and then about 2 o'clock on Saturday and Sunday and going into midnight or so. But we utilize all the stages at the Max and the outdoor stage. We close off Parsons Street and we have a rhythm stage out there. And there's food vendors and there's kids' activities, crafts, and people from all over the world coming together to visit Detroit as well as artists from all over the world coming to perform in Detroit. And so it's a really great time.
It is. And Ralph Valdez, is only one thing that you didn't emphasize enough, and that again, that it's free. It's absolutely free. One time, a friend of mine from England said, I was telling him about it, and he said, what's the fee? About $150 for the entertainment, what you would have to pay.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's for sure.
To see these individual artists. I don't even want to begin to tell you what I paid to see Bob Dylan.
Right. And I go to a music festival, and it's about 5 days of music,
yeah,
and I pay $400 to go to this city.
Right.
Wow.
That's what's so amazing about the Concert of Colors. And with the price of gas now, we're saying this, you can see the world for less than a tank of gas, depending on where you're coming from. But, you know, can you imagine just being able to see all these artists all in one weekend here in Detroit? And, yeah, they're high-caliber artists, as well as, of course, the great Detroit artists that we're very proud to have as part of the history of the Concert of Colors. We've always tried to emphasize and support the local music scene as well. So it's a really, really good festival, and I hope everybody listening can come out.
And the website for it?
It is simply concertofcolors.com, And you'll find much more information about each day's schedule at the website, concertofcolors.com. The Maxim Fisher Music Center is the home of the DSO, as I mentioned, but it's for those who are not as familiar with the Detroit area, it's on Woodward, just north of Mack and just south of Warren, centrally located, easy to get to.
And south of Wayne State University, essentially.
Exactly. And a beautiful building.
And Jalene looked, had a question mark on her face when you said question mark and Mysterians.
It seems familiar.
It's a Detroit band, right? Back from the back in the day.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't here.
Oh, okay. Well, he was originally, I believe, from, he's actually Mexican, of Mexican-American descent from Saginaw, the Saginaw area.
Michigan, okay.
Michigan, but yeah, had a big local hit, and then it became a national hit with 96 Tears.
Oh, well, there
you go.
There.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So, yeah, he's just, okay. He's. I've seen him perform live in the past, and he puts on an amazing show full of energy and just a great entertainer. And he's going to be celebrating, I think, a new release. So he's going to have a lot of stuff to be pumping up. Question Mark and the Mysterians are going to be performing at the Concert of Colors for free on Saturday at 7 p.m. on the diversity stage, we call it, which is inside the DSO and the music box.
Well, it's an absolutely incredible event. I've been probably to all of them, and they're stunning in the breadth of the type of music that's presented. It would be impossible, no matter what your musical taste, even if it's extraordinarily narrow, not to find, and now the fact that the Detroit Symphony Orchestra is there, it's absolutely impossible to find some genre of music, let alone if you let your imagination run right and open to other kinds of music. It's all there. Well, Ralph, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show and telling our listeners about this. Again, it's concertofcolors.com. I'll see you down there.
Yeah, thank you very much for the time. And it's Thursday, July 19th through the 22nd at the Max.
See you there.
It's free. Bye-bye.
Bye, Ralph.
It's absolutely incredible. And I don't know if everybody will know who this is, but I was at a dinner 4 or 5 years ago for the Concert of Colors people.
I know who you're going to say.
Buffy St. Marie.
Yeah.
This beautiful native Canadian woman.
Gorgeous.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I sat right next to her, and she said, "Hi, I'm Buffy St. Marie." And I felt like...
I know.
I couldn't even think of anything. I said, "Hi, I'm Peter Werby." And she looked at me, she smiled, and I'm thinking, say something!
You're never at a loss for words.
I was. I couldn't.
Ever.
What am I going to say? I really like your music. You know. Damn.
Well,
what? Oh, you're going to the Women's Music Festival.
I am in a few weeks. Yeah.
A few weeks.
I won't be missing any of these shows.
Isn't this all like...
I arranged it so you couldn't get away from me.
Isn't this all gay women?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay.
And little old me.
And you little old you. Yeah, there's one in every crowd.
Whatever that is.
Right. 313-298-WRIF. 313-298-WRIF. Don't worry.
9743. See how quickly you are distracted.
I am
Peter.
Distracted.
Back to the business.
All right. Wait a minute here. Yeah. I wanted to say, actually, I wanted to read this email real quickly, just a few lines. But also, it's from Clint in Dearborn. Clint sends me, and that's what I ask you. A lot of people, though, say, they send me stuff from the New York Times. I mean, why would you do that?
Every day.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So don't do that. Clint finds a lot of stuff that I don't see.
We appreciate the thought. But
yeah.
Go ahead, Clint.
Hi, Peter and Jalene. Totally agree with you on stopping war and reactivating a progressive income tax system, which means that if you make over $10 million, it's confiscatory almost. It confiscates everything except for maybe a 10%. So for every million after $10 million, you only get $100,000.
I don't know.
That's tough.
There's a lot of people.
Imagine if we were to educate all people, provide new infrastructure, and provide free health care, then we may go back to the society where there is less crime and more economic growth like we used to have when we were growing up. We would have a more stable society and the recreation of the middle class. Just imagine the wealthy would make more money because people like you and me would buy more and make them wealthier. I ain't buying any more.
No more purchasing?
Yeah.
No all matter right. what.
All right. Let's see here.
Phone calls. We have a lot.
Yeah, phone calls. Here's Archie in Detroit. Archie, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Whoa.
Hi, Peter?
Yeah.
Hi, this is Archie from Detroit.
Yeah, hi. You're on the air.
Well, I just want to say, I don't have any problem with health care and stuff. I make about $25,000 a year. And I think you're a pinko, and God bless George Bush, and go to Canada and take Jennifer Granholm with you.
You know what? I think one of two things.
Wait, first of all, he kind of contradicted it himself.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Either he was kidding.
Okay.
Could have been kidding.
I don't think he was kidding.
Then he's a moron.
Okay.
All right. Because anybody making $25,000 a year and...
who likes George Bush?
Yeah, is a fool.
Please, come on.
Really, I'm sorry.
Dude.
What I mean by a moron is it your capacity for thought about your own self-interest and that of your family is severely limited. And a fool is...
distorted.
Yeah, is because you're allowing yourself to be fooled by rhetoric, and it's not these are people, then we get back to the authoritarian personality thing, these are people that love the king, love the ruler, that love, maybe I remember, Hitler was loved, Stalin was loved, Mao was loved by millions of people in those societies, and it's because people that they cannot deal, I mean, it's a whole thing wrapped up with the father, that they don't have the psychological courage to revolt against the father displacement figure.
Just authority figure. Yeah.
Exactly. So no matter what dad does to you, no matter how much he rips you off and punishes you and steals your money and everything like that, you still love dad. Because actually, you'd like
to prove that you're a good person.
Psychoanalytically, you'd like to kill him, but you can't deal with those thoughts.
Pinko,
so
Peter, what
happens?
What do you say to people when they say that? You get that a lot.
Oh, Pinko?
Yeah.
All right.
Well, here and there.
I don't know. Pinko, that's like, that's why I thought he might be kidding, because that's something from like the 50s.
Well, yeah, I know.
Because there were Reds, you know, communists.
Yeah.
And then there were Pinkos, kind of people that were, you know, they thought were communist supporters and all that. But what kind of commie lets the rich still have $10 million a year?
Hey, good point.
Commies want to take it all.
So there you go.
There you go. Here is Tim in Lincoln Park. Tim, it's Peter and Jelaine.
How you guys doing? I'm laughing at this previous caller. I mean...
Well, what do you think? Well, wait a minute. Tell me. Do you think he was kidding? Or...
No, I think he meant it. I mean, I think he came across as humorous, but you get a lot of that in this country. You have a lot of people that are not that well-educated, and they buy into this idea of individualism, that, okay, if they work hard enough, they can kind of rise through the class system and make money.
Mm-hmm.
The trouble with that is I think the chances of anybody, like, being in the lower class or rising to the upper class is, like, next to nothing.
Well, yeah, as we always say, or I always bring up, it's just like the caste system in India.
But even if you buy into a lot of this capitalist stuff, okay, a lot of these jobs are going over to China. And, okay, so I'm working hard at a plant or whatever, and if the head of GM says, well, we got to move the plant overseas, you know, I'm out of luck.
Right.
You know, I'm on the street, so. Oh, and one more thing before
You do that, let me just, I just grabbed this from an editorial in the New York Times. Again, here, they represent the wealthy financier class, but they don't like what's going on. In their editorial, The Land of Opportunity, they say recent research surveyed by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, a governmental think tank for the rich nations, found that mobility in the United States is lower than in any other industrial country. Let me just say that again, that you have less of a chance to move upward in the class structure than any other industrial country in the world. So
number one?
Well, we're number one in that. I was going to say that because we're not really number one in anything.
A lot of bad things.
Yeah, a lot of bad things. But really, it's the other way around. We're number like 30 or something. One study found that mobility between generations, people doing better or worse than their parents, is weaker in America than in Denmark, Austria, Norway, Finland, Canada, Sweden, Germany, Spain, and France. So we're at the bottom of the pile in terms of upward class mobility, and that is structured. That is structured into the system. Go ahead, Tim.
Well, you have like the French, I mean, who were really demonized during the war. I mean, these guys, it's mandated, I think, by law, they have 5 weeks of vacations every year. They still have big, you know, companies like Airbus and all those companies that make a lot of money. But they have a healthcare system, so if people get sick, I mean, the government picks up the tab and it picks it up through relatively low tax rates.
Yeah.
So you could still have, you know, you could still have market economics, but I mean, you would have the government effectively backstopping people so they wouldn't fall out of the system.
Absolutely. Thank you for joining us. Here's Marianne in Dearborn. Marianne, it's Peter and Jelaine. You're on the air. Hi. Marianne. Okay, Marianne. Oh, I see what I got to do. This is one of these things where I actually got to push the button. When do you think I'll learn how to do this, Jillian? Hi, Marianne, now you're on the air. Go ahead.
Okay, yes, I want to run a scenario by you. I was calling my congressman the other day, which I do weekly to let him know my feelings.
This is McCotter?
That would be...
Or Dingell.
Dingell.
Dingell,
right.
Yeah, John Dingell, right.
But I made a mistake, and because, Conyers, but Dingell's name is right under Conyers' name. So I accidentally called Dingell's number, and I hit the button, and a woman came on, and I said, is this Congressman Conyers' office? She said, no. And then I looked down, and I said, oh, is it Congressman Dingell? She said, no, this is the FBI. And I said, really? Where is this? And she gave me 202-278-0000, which is absolutely not the number I dialed, not even close.
Isn't that the White House?
I hung up, and then I dialed that number, and it was a non-working number.
So what do you make of this?
I don't know what
she didn't want to deal with. She didn't want to deal with it.
You know?
Yeah.
And, you know, I give to the ACLU, Amnesty International, I'm not patting myself on the back, been to a few peace demonstrations, stuff like that, let my legislators know regularly how I feel. I'm small potatoes.
Now,
and I started
all of us small potatoes can make one big, I don't know.
Potato salad.
Yeah.
Right. But
yeah.
You know, I started getting, after that happened, I started getting paranoid that I'm thinking, nah, it can't be.
You know what I generally think, Marianne? Nah, it probably isn't. It's actually a long discussion about who previously in other eras were spied upon and what the purposes of the government was. At 1 a.m., I'm going to be interviewing Chris Finan, who's written a book called The Fight for Free Speech in America. I mean, here, we got the First Amendment. That after it says there shall be no establishment of religion, it says that Americans should have freedom of speech. So why would there ever have to be a fight for free speech? And stuff like you're talking about has the capacity to still speech. People get frightened to be able to speak their mind. Well, I would say in general, although there's been some terrible periods in American history, in the 1950s around World War I and to some extent in the 1960s and some even under Bush. But in the main, people that were bound and determined to change things in this country didn't let stuff like that turn them around. And fortunately, with some notable exceptions, is that the people that have spoken their mind, people that have been activists for change through the 18th and 19th and 20th century, generally were part of the change. I mean, there's been deaths along the way in the civil rights movement and the unionization movement and all that, but mostly people could do it in a manner consistent with the Constitution. But, well, I mean, there's been too much repression on the part of government all along, but you'll hear that at 1 a.m. All right, I've got to take a break. Thank you, Marianne. Peter Werby, Jillian Jordan, 313-298-WRIF. If you didn't hear at the beginning of the show, when we come back, we'll tell you how to grab two tickets to a documentary that Jillian and I are going to be hosting this Thursday.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Yeah.
RiffsPhone.com. More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome back to our second hour. Jalene Jordan joining me.
Yes.
And Jalene and I will be hosting a brand new documentary about the occupation of Iraq. It's called No End in Sight. It's going to be Thursday, July 19th, 7:30 p.m. at the Main Art Theater. It's at 11 Mile in Main, and best of all, it's free. And we're going to have a post-film discussion that Jalene and I will be moderating. And we've invited all these anti-war groups. So some of you are always saying, what can we do? I'm against the war. You know what the percentage of people that say the Iraq war is going good? 3%.
Really?
Who the hell are these nuts?
Okay, so I got to get all these percentages down. Now, we have Bush at the, 27, isn't
yeah,
that?
Yeah.
So really with the
margin of error.
Yeah, so he's really about 24, 23. Yeah. And then Congress is lower.
What is that?
Congress is something like 22%. Approval rating.
Well, I suspect that even liberal Democrats are giving them bad marks because now the Democrats are funding the war. The reason that Bush keeps...
And corporations. Yeah. I mean, they're buying into the corporations.
Sure. The reason that Bush keeps coming back and asking for funding is he's required to under the Constitution because the Founding Fathers did not want more than 2 years to go by. It's in the Constitution that they would have to ask for more appropriations. Yeah. So if the Democrats wanted to end the war, all they have to do is not send a funding bill to Bush.
You know what? This is the only time he's followed the Constitution.
Yeah,
I just
exactly.
thought about that.
Well, I don't know why we are there. I think hopefully most people caught this. Nouri al-Maliki, the prime minister of Iraq, shrugged off U.S. doubts of his government's military and political progress on Saturday, saying Iraqi forces are capable and American troops can, quote, leave any time they want. Now, you get this, folks?
Even the president of Iraq.
Yeah, prime minister.
Prime minister. Well, yeah, thank you.
Right.
Sorry.
The prime minister said that the American troops can leave anytime they want. Well, the polls are just out. The American troops want to leave. The American people want us to leave. The Iraqi people want us to leave. The Iraqi people think that the main cause of violence in Iraq are the presence of the occupying troops, our troops. You know, Jalene, I'm glad I forgot what I saw right before I left my house. There was a piece on Yahoo News about GIs that had been burned in attacks. It was so horrible. Ugh. I read about three paragraphs.
You had to stop.
I said, I can't. I mean, it described one young man, and I will spare you and the audience what it's all about. And, of course, when the United States is flying F-14th and helicopter assault ships into packed urban areas, that's what's happening to Iraqi people as well. I was down at the Women in Black had an anti-war demonstration on Saturday, and I was down there, and there was a jet flyover. I don't know why, I couldn't tell what plane it was. And I forgot how loud and how frightening that is to to have to use those for urban combat is just absolutely incredible. So let me ask you this. If you're one of the, I don't know, what, 18% or 20% of the people that still support U.S. presence in Iraq, what do you think about the fact that the prime minister of Iraq said that the American troops can leave anytime they want, and the American troops want to leave? Here. Among military families, let me start this again. Among military members and their immediate families who responded to a national New York Times CBS News poll in May, two-thirds said things were going badly. These are the men and women that are over there, compared with just over half, about 53% a year ago. Fewer than half of the families and military members said the United States did the right thing in invading Iraq. So why are we there? Because we're fighting. We're fighting Al-Qaeda. We're fighting Al-Qaeda.
He brought that.
Another Bush lie.
Bush this week really amped that up, didn't he?
Yeah. And now we're fighting Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Of course, he doesn't bother to say that
he's the reason Al-Qaeda's in Iraq. Okay.
But it's not the same Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia, as they also call it, did not exist before the September 11th attack. And it's a Sunni group that is getting 50% of its manpower, not from Iran, not from, because they're Shiites, mm-hmm. not from Syria, not from Jordan, from our Saudi Arabia. That's right. That's what's going on. So everything that Bush says continually is a lie. So
the country where help me, 9/11, all the guys on the planes.
From Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia. And then now they're supporting this Sunni group, and we're not even threatening them.
Well, here's a couple of things. The United States is trying to make peace with some of these Sunni groups, hoping that they will fight Al-Qaeda in Iraq. But the Shiite government of al-Maliki is saying, wait a minute, you are supporting these terrorists who are fighting our Shiite militia. So it's really a horrible situation that Bush is responsible for. And the idea that he is responsible for hundreds of thousands of deaths.
And they sleep at night.
And hundreds of thousands of people, you know, like we just see now in our returning burn victims from Iraq is just, I don't know, I can't imagine that anybody could still support this. Yeah, the Army missed its recruiting goals in June for the second straight month. Fell more than 1,000 active duty recruits short. Lieutenant Colonel Dan Baggio, an Army spokesman, declined to confirm the numbers. And he said, we're not in a doomsday situation. When we don't make the goal, that is something of a concern, but we're not panicking. No, all they're doing now is letting men in with criminal records. So there has been, in fact, I don't know if I still have that.
Pretty soon they'll have it up to, you can be in there past age 60.
Yeah. One of al-Maliki's top aides, Shiite lawmaker Hassan al-Sunseed, accused the United States of embarrassing the Iraqi government by violating human rights. So here is the government we're supporting charging the United States Armed Forces with violating human rights. And we've seen an extraordinary amount of that, if you've been following some of these. And he said it treats his country like, quote, an experiment in the U.S. lab. These are the people that we're expending our fortune on and our lives, who say that we can leave anytime that we want. So let's get the hell out right away.
Thank you.
Any objections to that? Well, we're talking about the looting of the population, the world's population, by the ultra-wealthy. Scott from Ann Arbor writes, I happen to get a bitch.
A little bit, just a little bit.
I happen to catch a little bit of your show on my drive home. First, one problem with taxing the rich 90%. Now, Scott, remember, we're leaving them with $10 million. It's 90% after on every million after that. They'll leave, he says. Right now, we at least get some money from them. But if we take all their money and move to tropic, they will take all their money and move to tropical islands. We'll end up with even less in taxes than we started with. Well, this is blackmail again, right? We have to continue to let them loot the common wealth that's produced by all of us, including them, or they're going to leave, right? So, I don't know. I don't buy that.
Thanks for writing, though.
Yeah. Okay. Here's Chris in White Lake. Chris, it's Peter and Jolene. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF.
Hello. You're talking about the state of the economy and all of the money problems that America's having right now, right?
Well, American people, yeah.
Well, me and my brother were listening to your show, and we happened to catch when you were reading out of the paper how there is little to no chance that American people can move up the economic ladder in America. Now, if that really is the case, why wouldn't more people be moving out of America to move to places where they could move up the ladder, like Germany?
Wait, I can answer that. Because they don't have enough money to move.
Well, wait a minute. If you knew that this was, I mean, I don't, you may be doubting these statistics, but if you knew that you had a good chance, mostly, you know, there's classes in Germany and France and Italy as well. There's just a better chance to move up the class structure and more class mobility in these other countries. The United States just happens to be dead last in terms of class mobility. But would you move to Italy if you knew that, I live here. You live here, right? We're not going to leave our homes and our families and all that.
Well, who said we had to leave our homes and our families?
Well, you're saying that why aren't more people leaving to go to places where there's better opportunity? I mean, we're not going to leave. We want to stay here, right?
Is it better for your family? Well, right now, me and my brother could, in essence, move to Germany because we have an uncle that could take us in and we could find work out there, so we would still be with family.
Okay, well,
that's a very nice, unique situation for you. What about everyone else who doesn't have an uncle in Germany or France? I don't.
Well, here.
But I'd love to move to France tomorrow, to be honest.
Why wouldn't you, take advantage of that? I mean, for one thing, United States workers get about, average 9 days vacation a year. Germany's, by statute, gets 5 weeks. The minimum wage is like 10 or 12 bucks an hour. There's free medical care.
Wouldn't it be better for your family to move over to a place where it's so much easier then?
Well, let's all go. Let's all move to Germany. You, your brother, Peter, and I, let's go.
I'm not sure what your point is, though. Yeah, I mean,
are you saying if you don't like it, get out?
No, you're the one saying you don't like it.
No, are you saying to us, if you don't like it, and to the people who aren't happy with the situation, are you saying, why don't you just get out? That's kind of what you're saying, really, aren't you?
Yeah.
Well, okay. It's all right. We can take it.
I mean, it's kind of, it doesn't get us anywhere. But
no.
Are you doubting that the United States has the lowest upward class mobility of any of the industrialized countries?
Sure, you never point out.
What?
Wait, I think you were talking while he was talking to you.
Say your last
name. Ask him again, Peter.
Are you saying that the United States does not have the lowest upward class mobility of any industrialized country, as the study shows?
Well, the problem with studies is sometimes they're wrong.
Okay. All right. Sometimes they are. You're absolutely right. All right. Thank you very much. But you can also tell somewhat anecdotally as well. Ever.
Say hi to your uncle in Germany.
Yeah,
maybe we'll go live with him.
Here's Miguel in St. Clair County.
Maybe I will.
Hey, Miguel. Welcome to the program. Yeah.
How you doing, Julie?
Great.
Check it out. For one, we got a serious problem with George being in office. That's number one.
That's right.
Because, first of all, okay, the Prime Minister of Iraq wants us out of there. Let us go. There ain't no, you know why he wants us out of there? Because he's got his money. All the money that we've invested for helping them and doing this for other countries, anything. What do you think? That's not going to backfire on us? They waiting for us. Why do you think Canada don't even stick their nose in any of our business? They never do. Because why? Because they have medical insurance for everybody in Canada. We should have that. We're one of the best superpower nations in the world. Why can't we have that? We're always in debt. And it's ridiculous. And then you have health care for the kids. Oh, we can't give them health care. Oh, but it's all right for Oprah and Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie to go over there to South Africa and New Orleans and put their money invested, huh? What, Bush didn't ask them to do that. They did that on their own.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's
so many points. Wow.
There is such an enormous amount of hypocrisy. And Miguel, you have just opened the door for our conversation about hypocrisy.
Thank you, Miguel.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for joining us. And once again, the Republicans have been exposed for the extraordinary hypocrites that they are, both Jalene and I, reaching for our stories about Louisiana's Senator David Vitter. He said he sinned, and he was sorry, hours after Hustler magazine told him his telephone number was among those disclosed by the D.C. madam. Now, the D.C. madam was running this little domination joint. Wasn't that the deal?
It wasn't. She said it wasn't necessarily, sexual activity. It was more,
But he, being Senator Vitter, another one of these extraordinary hypocrites. I mean, what more can you say about him? Because when you find out about him, he's written all this stuff about that. In fact, he had written this article for the New Orleans paper advocating the impeachment of Bill Clinton because of violations of marriage vows. And here's this guy, doing prostitutes.
And he got caught. I love this part the most of all about his wife.
Go ahead.
Okay. At the time when he said this about Clinton, his wife warned at the time what she would do if she caught her husband committing adultery, which she now has caught him, by the way, with numerous and many years of prostitutes. I'm a lot more like Lorena Bobbitt than Hillary. I'm walking away with one thing, and it's not alimony. Trust me. Either Vitter's not sleeping at home now, or he's locked up the kitchen knives.
That's right. You go to, BuzzFlash.com's GOP Hypocrite of the Week. So many.
But he wasn't even the Hypocrite of the Week.
No.
They go on to someone else.
Go ahead. This is cool.
They go on to Florida Republican State Representative Bob Allen. Now, they did say picking David Vitter as the Hypocrite of the Week would have been the easy thing to do, but let's go to a more unheralded soul, Florida Republican State Representative Bob Allen, who was arrested July 10th and charged with soliciting an undercover male officer for sex at a park in Central Florida. He said that investigators said Allen was acting suspicious, went in and out of the men's restroom at the Veterans Memorial Park, and minutes later, Allen solicited the male officer inside the restroom, offering to perform oral sex on the officer for $20. So then they go on to say, Allen is not only accused of being a pervert, he goes down cheap, too.
this is just so amazing because, let me see here.
So it's the Republicans. I know something, Bill Clinton did his whatever.
Well, they're already talking with the governor, because he's a Democratic governor, about the GOP is the grand old party. It ain't the grand old party anymore, but anyway.
Grand old perverts.
The grand old perverts. Yeah, the greedy oil people or whatever they are.
Yeah, there's so many.
But because if he resigns, if Senator Vitter of Louisiana resigns, mm-hmm. then the Democratic governor gets to appoint the replacement.
Right.
So they're negotiating with her, because one of the things that Vitter said when he was talking about, he said that Clinton should be forced from office because of his
adultery.
That was sufficient cause for being forced from public office. But he says that he's made his peace with Jesus and with
Yes. But the really funny part is that Larry Flint, you said Hustler magazine earlier, Larry Flint is the one going after all these guys. Larry Flint.
I love it.
I do love it.
Senator Vitter, an uncompromising foe of abortion and same-sex marriage.
Of
these guys here. But one of the interesting things, I don't know if you caught this part of it, that there is there's a Rudolph Giuliani connection. that Senator Vitter, the guy that got outed by the D.C. madam, was the head of the Rudolph Giuliani, the Rudy Giuliani presidential campaign in Louisiana. I mean, these guys, they defy the imagination. Absolutely defy the imagination. And I think you may remember, well, yeah, here, Vitter serves as the regional chairman of Giuliani's campaign in the South. Recently, Giuliani's South Carolina finance chair, Tom Ravenel, quit the campaign after it was announced he'd been indicted on federal cocaine distribution charges.
Oh,
I mean, these are the moral upright, I mean, they're just...
They're spewing all of these moral values at everyone else. Yet they're leading these double lives, and not only just being hypocrites, like really to the full extent.
Yeah. When Giuliani was mayor of New York, he had two affairs outside of his marriage to his wife. Now, like the mayor of it's got a long Spanish name, and I can't remember it now. The mayor of Los Angeles has just come out that he's had this long-term affair with this one. And it was like, yeah, so what? You know, who could it have been? Mitterrand, with one of the presidents or prime minister, back to that, of France. When he passed away, both his wife and his mistress attended the funeral.
I remember that, yeah.
And nobody cared because he wasn't saying, I defend Christian morality,
right. The
sanctity of marriage.
Yeah.
And so, like, the mayor, I mean, I think the mayor may be catching a little heat for it, but he's like, whatever. I mean, if you set yourself up as this paragon of virtue and decency and are opposed to all these horrible things, and then you turn out to be a preacher, that's backing an anti-gay marriage amendment, and you're doing blow and...
With a male prostitute.
With a male prostitute.
Doing blow and doing the male prostitute.
Yeah. There's no end to this.
Not sure which order that went in.
Yeah. What? Okay. I can't believe these guys. 313-298-WRIF.
Laughable, Peter.
Let's go to Jim. Jim is in Auburn Hills. Hi, Jim. It's Peter and Jolene.
Yeah, Peter, Jolene, you know, I love how you grasp upon the fact that the Republicans, I mean, the two gentlemen you were speaking about, obviously don't reflect the entire Republican Party.
Well, we know
most
that.
Most of them. Most of them.
You grasp upon that. And it's
Wait.
Should we just breeze over it? What happened to Bill Clinton, for crying out loud?
Now, you ever hear about, what about Newt Gingrich? What about...
I want to know about Bill Clinton. Do you say Bill Clinton represented all the Democrats?
Wait. There's a difference. The difference is,
that's what I'm talking about.
Democrats and liberals, they just thought, what a goofball. You know, they weren't, like, horrified. And the guys that were leading the horrifying charge, Newt Gingrich, the Republican Speaker of the House.
While he was leading it, he was...
Yeah.
Stooping another babe.
Yeah. Robert Livingston, who was supposed to take over from Gingrich, who was exposed for having an affair. And then you've got, what was the guy, that was doing all the pages? Foley.
Yes, Mark Foley.
There's a history here. You really don't find these kind of exposés of this deep a nature and this contradictory nature. Hey, look at a lot of liberals and Democrats are libertines. They think that, you know, they believe in free love. They believe in sexual experimentation. You know, and if you said, hey, we caught this liberal Democrat, tied up by a dominatrix and...
With
the ball gang, they go, yeah, what the hell? What's the difference?
Yeah,
you know, that's what I want to do.
Enjoy your life.
I'm not hurting anybody. But when you find out, and usually it's Republicans that are doing it, that kind of stuff, they've already, been introducing legislation that's sexually repressive. That's what's so disgusting about it.
Hey, well, Peter, as I say, the head guy, you're the head guy representing the Democratic Party. I mean, you did the ultimate. I mean, you call it what you will, you label it what you will if it makes you guys feel better, but...
Wait, are you talking about Clinton? Do you care that Clinton was doing some intern? I couldn't care less. I mean, it's like a bad joke because, it's like when you find out one of your buddies got caught in an in an act of infidelity, and you go, whoa, man, he was catching hell from his wife. But you don't want to fire him from his job or anything like that. But when you present yourself publicly as the deacon of morality, and then you find one after another, I mean, you find out that, you know, the Bush had these arrests for cocaine, and I mean, Bush is the only president that ever entered office with a criminal record. Yeah, okay, I see some silence there, so we're going to move on. Thank you, sir. Well, tell me, folks,
I think he's calling us hypocrites.
Well,
but we didn't care that Clinton, I mean, as a woman, I was a little annoyed, you know, by his infidelity,
yeah.
But, you know,
one of these guys,
I got over it.
One of these guys said that, you know, Reagan wouldn't even take off his jacket in the Oval Office.
Oh, I mean, don't get us started.
I mean, Clinton was a first-level jerk.
You know, they didn't call him Slick Willie for nothing.
Yeah, they didn't call him. I mean, on the other hand, John Kennedy, I mean, he was doing Marilyn Monroe in the
and
White House.
And everyone knew
yeah,
it.
You know what his nickname was? Mattress Jack. Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
so,
people adore him to
yeah.
this day.
And so you say, oh, so John Kennedy was committing infidelity in the White House.
Yeah. You know what? Who
I couldn't care
less. Most of all, was it just, it was, it's the wives. I mean, it's the
yeah.
families.
It's a family
when
affair.
When it comes down, yeah.
yeah. I mean,
I won't sing it.
The only reason that I would have any reaction if we found out that George Bush was doing something like that is, again, he's always talking about, you know, his favorite philosopher is Jesus. And
no, we'd be surprised that he was having sex.
You never can tell.
Ew.
Here's
sorry,
Al,
I ever
Alan,
that.
I don't even like the idea. Here's
not
Alan Easter.
God.
Yeah, how you doing tonight, Peter and Jolene?
We're doing
yeah,
good.
Good.
Looks like it's the night the right strikes back.
Oh, here on the show?
Well, here,
yeah.
Yeah, some nights are a little
okay.
heavier right load than others.
Yeah,
we
I mean,
welcome it. We
I
welcome
feel,
it.
I feel badly for him being in this infinitesimal minority, you know?
Oh, you're so sweet, Peter.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I feel sorry for him, too, because it's like you're deluded.
Yeah, I'm deluded? Oh, they're deluded, yeah.
I have to disagree with you on the hypocrisy of a Florida senator that was performing oral sex or asking to.
Why?
Why?
That's why you elect politicians, constituent service.
Are you on a cell phone?
Say it one more time.
Are you on a cell phone?
Say it one more time.
Your line, you broke up right when you hit your punch.
Oh, I'm sorry. I said it's called you elect them for constituent service.
There you go.
Public service.
I mean, listen, there are gay Republicans, but I don't think...
The Log Cabin Republicans
yeah,
is one of the organizations.
That's one of the and I don't know if there's... Are there any gay Republicans in Congress right now?
None that are out.
Right.
Yeah. Well, there were.
The only one that's out I can remember is Barney Frank.
No, well, he's
a Democrat.
But no, there was... I thought there was one... But anyway... If we found out that a liberal Democrat was a gay, who cares? I don't care what people's sexuality is. But again, if there is a Republican and all of them are banging the drum against same-sex marriage,
I didn't know where you were going.
And the sanctity of marriage and all of that, and then you find out that he's gay, you go, oh man. I mean, for one thing, how the hell do they live with themselves? What?
The vice president's daughter just had a baby with her wife?
Yeah, exactly. Who is? I mean, that's... I don't know.
I feel sorry for her.
I don't get these
having
people.
Having that man as a father. Oh.
They are twistoids. All right. Thank you, Al. Thanks for joining us. All right. We got some open lines for you. We're going to take a break, but come back, and when we come back, we'll take your calls at 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743.
Looking out there.
The pictures, the podcast,
the vlogs,
the special features you just can't get
anywhere else.
Super cool.
Get them online at WRIF.com.
I said, who just that?
Or check us out at MySpace.com/WRIF.
Guaranteed to be extreme.
Because we can always use more friends, and we won't be naked.
Does anyone else smell Astroglide?
101.
WRIF.
People are sexy and clever, and they always say something funny right before a commercial break.
Everything that rocks.
This is WRIM.com.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our final segment. Jalene Jordan is here with me as well. And it occurred to me when I mentioned before that Jalene and I will be hosting the showing of the documentary No End in Sight this coming Thursday, July 19th, 7:30 p.m. at the Maine Art Theater in Royal Oak, North Maine and 11 Mile Road. I didn't tell you how to get passes.
Free passes.
Free passes. Right. Just go to my website, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E. WERBE.com. And I think we're going to have a big, big turnout.
I'm really looking forward
to
it.
Yeah, I think it's going to be great.
Yeah. Hey, can I bring something up?
Absolutely.
You know, here at this rock and roll radio frequency here in the Motor City, we play a lot of Metallica.
Yeah.
And right before the Live Earth show, Metallica singer James Hetfield was investigated by UK airport officials who believed he was a terrorist. And this is why. They thought he might be involved in terrorism because of his Taliban-like beard. And I don't know what he's looking like now. What, you know, men change their facial hair. You keep your...
I saw the photo of him.
Did you see it?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I haven't seen a recent... And in fact, Metallica is one of the... I fell asleep during that Live Earth show, but I have it TiVo'd, and I need to go back and watch that performance, so I will do that. But he was allowed to leave the airport after a brief interrogation when he persuaded officials that he's a rock star.
There you go. This little item, too, an embroidery company agreed to pay $500,000 and its sales manager pleaded guilty to conspiracy for falsely claiming that American flag patches sold for military uniforms were made in the United States. And they were actually made in Thailand.
Oh, not even the U.S. military uniform patches are made in the United States.
Huh? Here's one thing that's beginning to circulate around the Internet, and even a good friend of mine in Georgia sent this, that that there's going to be this meeting. When the hell is this coming up? But Bush and President Calderon of Mexico and Stephen Harper, the Prime Minister of Canada, are meeting outside of Montreal. And the claim is on the Internet, mostly from this website called Prison Planet. I think it's just prisonplanet.com or .org. They've got good stuff sometime. I think it's a little wacky.
Okay.
But globalists, this says, political heavyweights are preparing to formally propose to Congress the merger of the U.S., Canada, and Mexico into a North American Union at the end of the summer when they're going to be holding the secret.
Oh, come on.
Yeah, none of the countries would agree to it. But
the United States especially.
Yeah, and Canada wouldn't.
Canada doesn't want any part of us.
Yeah, so I think you folks can calm down. It ain't happening. It is not going to happen. All right, let's take some more calls at 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Here's Jeff in Detroit. Jeff, it's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air. Hi.
Hey, yeah, I was saying, and I think that we should applaud Larry Flint. Cause,
all right, let's...
Larry!
Because even back in the time when they were trying to impeach Clinton, he said, you know, these Republicans who are calling for his head are nothing but hypocrites, and that he would pay money for information about their misdeeds. And sure enough, you know, we know that they are hypocrites, that they, you know, they're doing whatever we're doing, and even more. That's the part that really irks me to death, and is that they will get up there and talk about family values. And I've even seen where they had some kind of survey that said that Republicans were more churchgoers than the Democrats, as if to say that they were more holy or something. And you know, they're people just like us, and some of them have some really bad skeletons in their closet.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you think about, now I can't remember his name, it was from Auburn Hills, who said that, hey, I mean, essentially was that, like Clinton, I know, here's what he was saying, that we were sort of cherry-picking among the, you know, hundreds and maybe even thousands of Republican office holders, and you know, picking out them as being representative of the Republican Party.
No, you were right on in what you said to him. And the fact is that when you present yourself as this moral beacon and saying be like me, you know, I would not think of doing any of that stuff. And then we find out you were doing that and then some.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, that's the part that makes people say, wait a minute.
You know what Larry Flint said? This is his observation. He said, Republicans, and I, by the way, I love Larry Flint's new hobby. I really do. I like it better than his old one, I must say. What can I say? Republicans are more fun because they get caught so easily, Flint said. They've been living a repressed life all their life. Democrats are liberal. They wear it on their sleeve. Their sex life is what it is. They don't spend their whole lives trying to cover it up.
There you go.
Yeah, that's true.
To reiterate what you just said.
Thank you, Jeff.
All right.
Appreciate
Jeff.
It. Jeff? Thank you for calling, sir. And let's see. All right. We're going to talk to Charmaine in Bloomfield Hills. Hi, you're on the air. Charmaine, hi. It's Peter
hi.
And Jane on WRIF.
Hi. You know what? I am listening to your program for the first time. It was recommended to me.
Mm-hmm.
I have lived on both sides of the border. I am a Canadian citizen, and my family is all from Canada.
Mm.
And I have lived here most of my life in the United States. And actually, you know, what you're talking about with the Democratic background is about being more socialist and more sharing. But actually what I'm seeing in your program, and I don't mean to be disrespectful because initially, I mean, I know you're very well read, but we're starting to get into an ad hominem arguments, and that's exactly what the Republican Party always uses.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they used against the John Kerry election, and that's how Karl Rove got John Kerry, you know, the Fox News ran this thing that John Kerry really wasn't great in Vietnam, and they associated all the gay 22 states were voting on gay rights at the same time,
right.
You know, so they just went off and they checked off, oh, okay, Republican, no Kerry, no gay rights, you know, no.
You mean you think we're making ad hominem, in other words, attacking the man, as the word, the phrase in Latin means, rather than the policies by bringing up all this stuff about Republican hypocrisy?
Yes, I do. I think that the issues are so much more serious than that, and it's, you know, it's funny to laugh about that, and we can point it out, but the actual issues of health care and equality of education and, you know, the NRA and all of these other things are so much more important. And I think if we stayed away from the ad hominem argument, that we could actually pull together more and get more of the true values behind what the Democratic Party is about. And just now, this week, Time Magazine is coming out and saying the problem with the Democrats is that they aren't associating anything with religion,
mm-hmm.
which is really something that Republicans are very good at, okay, because they're very conservative, religious.
Yeah, but I think people have stopped falling from that, and actually kind of turns my stomach to see Hillary praying and all of that. Come on, I mean.
I do. It absolutely does, and if you really think about it, you know, the separation of church and state is supposed to be, like, you know, that's supposed to be automatic. And if you really think about what happened before our legislature just turned into a Democratic, you
majority,
know.
Majority, yeah.
Yes. We were actually not a balanced country anymore. And that's what we were founded on. We were founded on the three parts of government that would balance each other. Well, we had a Supreme Court, we had a legislature, and we had the executive branch, all Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
And it was corrupt. I mean, this is corrupt, okay? This is not America. And so I guess I'm not trying to put you down by any means, and a friend of mine recommended me to listen to this.
Well, let me say in response to that. First, I began probably the first half hour talking about the economic situation and where all of our tax dollars were being misused and how there ought to be a complete restructuring of the tax system and that the income ought to be used for our country and not just go to the ultra-wealthy. We talked about Iraq, and Jeremy, I was having a little fun because these guys, I'll tell you, I mean, for one thing, we're pretty thick-skinned, and you said things in a very respectful manner, and constructive criticism is good, but I guess I have to respectfully say I don't agree. I think that the quality of a person ought to be assessed. And I don't think that there's anything that,
it's funny that you say that. I don't mean to.
Go ahead.
Okay. A long time ago when Bill Clinton was running against George Bush, number one or whatever,
mm-hmm.
I had this long argument about the same exact thing because I thought the fact that it was coming out that Bill Clinton was, a perpetual cheater and all of this stuff, and I had this argument with a good friend of mine that, you know, that's a personal integrity issue.
Yeah.
And so that means that he wouldn't be a good president.
No, I don't believe that. I don't think these guys are bad politicians because of their contradictions. I mean, the hypocrisy is when they're absolutely stating one thing and doing 180-degree opposite, that they are morally corrupt under their own terms and definitions. That's what's important. I mean, Bill Clinton never talked about the sanctity of marriage and all of that. He was just a freewheeling guy. And
right. And the one guy, that's very true, but when you really think about it, it's like, I don't know, it's, if you get into ad hominem arguments, it's the key thing for the Republicans. They always do it, and they sell the, I hate to say it, but the unintelligent people that will just follow along with that.
Well, I think that could be the case, but...
But on a radio program, I have to say, you have to have a little bit of entertainment value and a little bit of fun once in a while, because all we do all week long is read depressing stories
about American soldiers getting burned over 90% of their body. So,
and we talk, and most of the program is quite serious, actually. So once in a while,
and
we talk about the ball gag, we apologize.
And these guys deserve it. Charmaine, thanks for joining me. I should move on to some more callers.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining. Welcome for the coming on, listening for the first time, and please join us again.
You know, all these talk shows for first-time callers, they have like a noise or something they do. Yeah, we don't have anything like that, Peter.
Yeah. So.
But we do have some entertainment value.
Here's Paul. Paul is in Grosse Pointe. Paul, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Julian.
Hi.
I've been listening to the show for a little bit. First time calling in with anything that I felt like I could contribute with. But
great. Welcome.
Basically, I just wanted to bring up, you know how every once in a while you get one of those emails, or if you have MySpace, you get somebody that posts something that says, you know, let's all boycott buying gas on X day, whatever, May 15th,
it was
whatever.
May 13th.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I get them all the time, and, you know, the simple fact is that we need to get our gas, you know, and unless you plan accordingly, you got to buy your gas the day before, you're still going to be spending it anyways.
Sure.
But,
yeah, we talked about that on the show. You're going to buy it the day before or the day after.
Okay, well, yeah, I try to listen as much as I can, but
what did you do? Did you buy
Well, basically what I'm kind of proposing is I got this new thing, a new email that, and I have yet to, like, really check the facts on it or anything, but I guess from the Department of Agriculture you can find out what gas companies, where they basically get their oil from, where they get supplied from.
Here you go. Citgo.
Yeah. exactly. That's what I didn't know if this had been covered in the past, so I just felt like calling up and, like I said, contributing.
Thank you so much.
Yeah,
Paul, here's my feeling. Dependence on oil in any regard is an absolute disaster. From pumping it to the wars that are fought for it. I mean, the United States, through our tax dollars, subsidizes the oil industry for hundreds of billions of dollars. Essentially, what we're trying to do is create the context for U.S. private oil investment in Iraq. That's what this war is all about. So these oil companies have been subsidized. This is corporate welfare for hundreds of billions of dollars. And it's totally toxic. We know that when it's refined and when it's spilled, when it's used and burned, and all of that. So no matter what country is selling it, it's an absolute disaster. And an economy and a transportation system based on it is a disaster. And saying nothing about the politics of the particular countries, whether it's Saudi Arabia or Venezuela, whatever. This is going a long way to say that I do know from reading and some from personal experience, that the profits from Citgo go to help the people of Venezuela and do not go into the pockets of either rich American investors who, or into these terrible states like Saudi Arabia, who is actually fueling and feeding the insurgents, the insurgency against the United States. So there. All right. Thank you, sir. Appreciate your call.
Lots of first-time callers. Wait, what's our noise going to be?
I don't know. No.
No, that was a good call.
Here's Paul in Los Angeles. Paul, hi. Thanks for joining us from some so far away.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. This is the first time I've listened to you. One of the stations I listen to in Los Angeles, KPCC, part of the National Public Radio Network, which I listen to online, was not coming online. It was deadened for some reason. So I said, well, the other station I listen to is KPFK, part of the Pacifica Network.
Right.
They were just music. I just wanted to see what was happening on, current affairs, right? So I looked in the file there, and I found your station and turned it on. I've been listening to it. It's very interesting.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, and the lady who was just speaking, the very courteous lady who was just speaking to you a few moments ago about perhaps you being a little extreme in your critiques of some of the hypocrites.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate what she's saying, and she does have a point up to a point, but there comes a point where, let me express this, maybe this is rather extreme expression, but and I say it in quotes, the quote-unquote administration currently, I'll call them the gang of criminals currently infesting the White House, is the worst presidency and the worst administration, quote-unquote, that has ever disgraced this nation. And they have lied, and lied us into a war, an immoral war. They are, we're going to have like, if America wakes up, there will have to be some kind of Nuremberg tribunal for these guys.
Whoa.
And that's not extreme.
Well, I agree with it all, but I thought you said you agreed with her a little. She'd probably think that, and I don't mean to speak for Charmaine, but she might think that you are being even more extreme than me.
Well, let's say the sexual peccadilloes, that is a big deal, especially when you have people who wrap themselves in the flag and call themselves patriots and call themselves born-again Christians that are anything but. And so you've got wolves guarding the shepherd's flock, you know. And
yeah.
This is what. Isn't there a scripture that says, "Beware wolves in sheep's clothing"?
Yeah, that's Republicans, where men are men and the sheep are nervous.
Yeah, I don't want to slam all Republicans because in many ways I would call myself a Lincoln Republican and a Roosevelt Democrat.
Really?
Well, see, I'm pro progressive. Industrial investment. You were talking about oil a moment ago. I would like to see. I'm pro nuclear, by the way. That's the cat among the pigeons. You know, I'm sure that's you. Maybe you don't like that.
But, well, you heard him gasp. I think.
I choked.
Well, you know that the fourth generation. We're at the fourth generation of nuclear fission reactors at the moment, and they are.
Well, see, we don't want a systems that there is no room for error. And we're not at that point with the technology with nuclear power. And the other thing is, we still have nowhere to put it. They got
it's extremely expensive.
This repository, you're right, it is expensive. This repository out in Nevada that ain't going to work. And this stuff is just piling up on the shores of Lake Erie here in Michigan. And I'm sure in California. Paul, I want to just thank you for joining us for the first time again. But I got to take a few more calls. I only got about 5 minutes. So thank you. We'll talk again, I hope.
Call again. Please listen. Yes.
Indeed. And let's see. As they say, here is Adam Adams in Gross Eel. Hi, Adam.
Hi. Ding, ding, ding. First time caller again.
Wow.
Great. Ding.
Hi, I'm Al Groziel. I recently went to a protest in Wyandotte, Michigan that I heard about on your show. So I wanted to thank you for that real quick.
Oh, you know.
Fabulous. We got an email from someone thanking us that several people had mentioned that they heard it on Night Call with Peter Werby.
Pam, you know, I thought I put it away here.
It's somewhere. You have so much paper.
I got too much paper here. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. It's so hard to get.
How was the protest?
It was good. I wish it went longer. It was only an hour long. So, but I'm younger than a lot. It was a lot of older people, so I could go for 2 hours. But
Well, that's what's unfortunate. You know, during the 1960s, it was like all young people and all the older people were going, tisk, tisk, you know, this, you shouldn't be doing this. And now, so many of the demonstrations are people that have matured from that era and sometimes even older. And they're happy to still be out there. They're the elders of the peace and social justice movement, due the greatest respect, and they're the stalwarts of it all. But they wonder, I wonder, you know, where in fact are the young people that always make up the bulk of every movement for change and have throughout American history. Now, I'll tell you, Adam, one of the things that you can do is go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, and there's a little skyline of Detroit, and that's where there's a calendar there. And there's actually not a lot of stuff on there at the current time. But it's a good place, and it lists the Wyandotte Vigil, the Ferndale Vigil. There's going to be an impeachment vigil on the third Saturday of every month at the offices of Congressman Sandra Levin. And, you know, the more that people send me, the more that I'll put up there. So there's lots going on. And part of it is that that you would think the Internet would bring us closer together. But I think, you know, people back in the day, they just had mimeograph machines.
I know. And I also feel that the media was maybe a little better in covering things like the Vietnam War and showing those images of Buddhist monks setting themselves on fire and things like that.
Yeah.
But one of my questions was, I was thinking about getting a weekly protest for universal health care. But the term today is so broad, and politicians aren't asked very specific questions about it. So I was just wondering what exactly you support. If it's Medicaid for all, like David Kucich, or just what along those lines would you see working out?
Well, I think Kucinich. Yeah, I didn't know who you meant. Congressman Kucinich, who's also running for president, who is of the whole pack, is one that I would give consideration to supporting. Yeah, you know, if you would email me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com, calltalkyes@yahoo.com, I'll put you in touch, and I don't know who it is off the top of my head. Maybe someone can email me and tell me where to email you, but there's lots of people working on this stuff, and certainly the momentum now, the political momentum is there for universal single-payer health care. That is that, and the, you know, the government is a single payer, so it's like every other country in the industrial world. I just looked at the clock, Adam. Are you going to join Jolene and me at this documentary? You're a little ways away, but we're going to be out in Royal Oak this coming Thursday.
I hope to be.
Hey, that'll be great.
Love to see you.
All right, thank you, and yeah, get involved. You know, there used to be a phrase about that Paul from Los Angeles mentioned about supporting nukes, and it used to be better active today than radioactive tomorrow.
Nice.
Let me see. What do we got to do for time here? We can maybe do real quickly. Here's Dave in South Lyon. Dave, you got to do it real quickly.
Okay. Thanks, Peter and Jolene. I just wanted to add to the discussion about the hypocrisy of the Republicans that you've been talking about. And I guess the only comment I would have is, first of all, I agree that it's terrible, you know, that these Republican leaders are saying one thing and then doing another. But I guess, in my opinion, that kind of thing goes across the aisles to both and any party. You know, you can find on the Democratic side, you know, a lot of folks that will say that they're, you know, that they represent the small guy, and yet we find out that they're living the high life, or we, you know, they may be speaking about how they're really against the oil companies,
and they're taking their money.
They're driving an SUV, you know. And
well, I don't think it's so much personal style. Here's what I would fault the Democrats for, and that is that, as you said, they will say they're the representative of the average man and woman, and then they're in the pocket of the corporations. That, in some ways, is worse corruption, because the Republicans are flat out corporate flacks. I mean, they represent the corporations. They represent the rich, and the idea is that the Democratic Party is the other party, the opposition. Well, the Democrats are not an opposition party enough. I mean, it's what Ralph Nader calls the Republicrats. that it's
that.
One party with two heads. And the difference has become more striking since the Republican Party has been 100% captured with far-right-wing pro-corporate ideologues and a pack of wacko psychos. Here are some ad hominem arguments or phrases for you. Well, I just looked at the clock on the wall. I got to go. We got to get into the next segment of the show. Thank you for your comments. All right. You want to join Jalene and me for this this documentary this Thursday, July 19th, 7:30 p.m. at the Main Art Theater in Royal Oak. Go to my website, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerby.com. PeterWerby.com. You'll see it right there. Click on it, and you'll get yourself a couple passes. Or just show up. No, we're not going to turn anybody away.
That's right.
All right. Stay tuned for Chris Fine, and he's going to talk about the fight for free speech throughout American history.
Thank you. To Al and Jeremy. Thank you, Peter.
Yep. Thank you. Bye.
This is WRIM.com.
We're back
with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Pleasure to be with you. Let me here real quickly grab my copy of the U.S. Constitution and go to the Bill of Rights, as most of us learned in civics class. That is the first 10 amendments to the Constitution. And Amendment 1, freedom of religion, press, and expression. And it begins with Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. The Founding Fathers were very clear about that. But then it says that that there should be no abridging of freedom of speech. Joining me is Christopher M. Finan. And Chris Finan is the president of the American Booksellers Foundation for Free Expression. He's worked for Free Expression Group since 1982. He's currently chair of the National Coalition Against Censorship, also a trustee of the Freedom to Read Foundation. He is the author of Alfred E. Smith, A Happy Warrior. And he lives in Brooklyn, New York, where Alfred E. Smith was a politician back in the 20s. The book that Chris Finan has written is called From the Palmer Raid to the Patriot Act, A History of the Fight for Free Speech in America. Chris Finan, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Oh, thanks very much, Peter.
Now, the reason I read the First Amendment to the Constitution about freedom of speech, why should there be a Chris Finan book about the history of fight for free speech in America? It's guaranteed.
It is guaranteed, but the fact is that we've had censorship in this country almost from the beginning, and that, you know, only 7 years after the adoption of that amendment by the Founding Fathers, one half of the Founding Fathers was trying to throw the other half of the Founding Fathers in jail for precisely speech that you would assume was protected by the First Amendment. It was speech critical of the government. It was the Jeffersonians criticizing the Federalists. And the law that was passed by the Federalist Congress made it a crime to say anything disparaging of the government. So these issues have very much been, you know, in play from the beginning.
Now, that's pretty typical of most governments. Many, many governments have laws forbidding criticism of the state. But the Founding Fathers, in their amazing wisdom, I mean, so most of us had civics shoved down our throat, so I think it's hard not to, it's hard sometimes to appreciate the genius that went into the this foundation document that is the basis of our government here. So the Founding Fathers, of course, knew the consequences of speech that the ruler didn't like in England, right?
Right. Well, that was the background, of course, for the Constitution and the First Amendment. Although, you know, originally not everybody was convinced that we needed a First Amendment. They believed that they had limited the power of the federal government just by the terms of the Constitution, and that the federal government couldn't interfere with free speech. And yet they found out just a few years later that that it could. So. But it's also true that there's a new intensity to the fight over free speech when the federal government itself begins to grow early in the 20th century. In fact, to fight, it grows largely to fight the war, to fight World War I. And that's when we have the first real sustained clash over free speech, and when a lot of people are put in jail for nothing more than criticizing America's intervention in World War I.
Well, maybe we can talk about that, because I was going to ask you, your book starts essentially in 1919 when the raids from the Attorney General Palmer began against the immigrants and radicals and unionists, and then you take it up to 2001 with the passage of the Patriot Act. So that's why it focuses on the 20th century and the early 21st century here. Because it's intensified, as you say.
Yeah, there had been censorship before. I mean, we had in this country a very far-reaching law called the Comstock Act, passed shortly after the Civil War, that made it extremely difficult to sell works dealing with sexual subjects, either fictional works or works that talked about even advocated changes in marriage or advocated birth control were banned under the Comstock Act. So there was a lot of censorship. But my book is really a study of the fight against censorship rather than the censorship itself. And that really begins, even though there are earlier battles. That begins in a sustained way, in a way that, you know, we, you know, our antecedents, my antecedents as a civil libertarian, you know, stretch back to 1917 and 1918 and 1919, and even more critically, 1920, when the American Civil Liberties Union is formed and becomes, you know, the center of the fight for free speech. What? So it's really a story of how our rights have expanded under the First Amendment since World War One.
I think when people say that George W. Bush has the most repressive government in American history, they really haven't read history. And certainly that probably the one of the worst periods, if not the worst period, was under a Democratic president with the lead up to World War One, the America's fight in it, and after. Do you accept that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think, you know, if the standards of World War One applied today, John Stewart would be in jail.
And I was going to say, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
No.
Yeah.
No, because really, the types of speech that were punished during World War One were, you know, some of the mildest expressions of disagreement with government policy. You know, kind of on a colloquial level. I mean, people were prosecuted for saying Wilson, you know, President Woodrow Wilson was a fathead. They were prosecuted for sending petitions to the government calling for changes in the draft laws. They were prosecuted for making movies that historical movies, in fact, that showed the British in a bad light. So it was the most basic kinds of speech that today we wouldn't, you know, we would be absolutely appalled if we saw people prosecuted, but there were 2,000 prosecutions during World War One, and we were only in it for 18 months. 2,000 prosecutions and over 1,000 convictions. The leader of the Socialist Party, which at this time at that time was a large third party in this country, Eugene Debs, was convicted of violating the Espionage Act for telling people. Even though he knew that government stenographers were taking down his every word, he thought he could say, you know, you have, you know, you're made for something better than slavery and cannon fodder. And for that, he gets convicted and sent to the federal penitentiary for 10 years.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say that there was also, besides government repression, official government repression, there was also vigilante suppression of people's right to speak as well.
Right. I mean, the government encouraged the formation, basically, of vigilante groups to weed out dissidents, and they took it on themselves sometimes in a very direct way. I mean, some of these vigilante groups, in fact, carried badges from the Department of Justice and took justice into their own hands and pulled people off of trains to search there to find out whether they were draft dodgers. And at the other extreme, you know, actually participated in the tarring and feathering of German Americans or socialists for remarks that were deemed unpatriotic. So while I wouldn't underestimate the pressure on free speech right now, I think there is pressure. It certainly can't compare to being thrown in a jail cell.
The book is From the Palmer Raids to the Patriot Act, A History of the Fight for Free Speech in America. Christopher M. Finan is my guest. It's published by Beacon Press, and you can go to Chris Finan. .com. That's FINAN.com. ChrisFinan.com. I'll have a link on my site as well, PeterWerby.com. In the area, you mentioned the Comstock Act, which forbid almost anything from going through the mails, birth control information, anything like that. And yet, many conservatives, cultural conservatives, say that there's no censorship anymore. That we have completely, the civil libertarians have completely obliterated any sort of restraint on. I mean, so anything is publishable, anything is showable, and to a large extent, that appears to be true. I mean, maybe in answering that, you could talk a little about how. I mean, everybody from Henry Miller to I'm trying to think of all the other D.H. Lawrence and James Joyce, you know, the classics of literature couldn't even be sold here in this country. So it would look on the face of it that other than like the problems with the Patriot Act, hey, we won.
Well, we definitely made important gains over the course of the last century in protecting artistic speech. And although that, you know, it's much more recent than you might imagine. You know, the Supreme Court doesn't really begin to protect artistic speech in this country until the 1950s. And there are still prosecutions in the early 1960s. In Tropic of Cancer, when Tropic of Cancer is published in the early 1960s, the police go on a rampage around the country, and there are 60 prosecutions of bookstores for selling what's widely acknowledged around the rest of the world as classic work of literature. And the fact is that what the Supreme Court does is it takes the definition of obscenity, which in the Comstock Act is there is no definition for obscenity. It's just anything that a jury might deem to be obscene can be suppressed, and it creates a definition for it, a three-part definition that dramatically narrows the range that government can of material that government can suppress. But it's important to remember that those laws are still those obscenity laws, narrowed obscenity laws, are now on the books in almost every state in the country, and they are occasionally used to prosecute and harass people for selling, you know, legitimate artistic materials. We, not that long ago, 1990, in fact, there was a real witch hunt going on in this country for books of nude photography by the acclaimed artist Jock Sturgis, and there were people going into Borders and Barnes and Noble stores around the country and ripping those up and encouraging prosecutions by local police on the claim that because they contained pictures of nude families, his subject was is often nude families in France, and because there were children nude in those pictures, that therefore it constituted child pornography. So there's a constant, you know.
I'm sure there's got to be some listeners saying, whoa, wait a minute. I'm for free speech and freedom of expression, but we're starting to move the line a little beyond what we see as a healthy expression of creativity or artistry. I mean, are there no lines? I mean,
the Supreme Court has a separate definition for child pornography, and child pornography defined by the Supreme Court is any picture that depicts a child engaged in sexual conduct or lascivious exhibition of the genitals. It's a very narrow definition. It's even narrower than the definition of obscenity, and nobody in the book publishing world, no bookseller, has a problem with that. The problem in this particular case of the Jock Sturgis books was that, you know, these were pictures of naked kids. They weren't lascivious. The kids weren't engaged in sexual conduct. You know, it was a work of art. And yet, some people viewed it as child pornography and set out to destroy these books and to force booksellers to stop selling them. And that effort failed because legally there was nothing wrong with these works. But I only raise the issue to point out that there are still laws on the books, and when there are still people who are aggrieved, as you say, cultural conservatives, and not just cultural conservatives, but also we've had attacks from feminists on the left on sexually explicit material in an effort to suppress that material. So we're in a much improved position in terms of being able to defend art from censorship today than we were 100 years ago. But the fight goes on.
Yeah, there's one type of censorship I do support, and that's self-censorship. If you don't like something, don't look at it, don't buy it, what have you. I mean,
right.
The idea that you can extend your sense of the world onto other people's by force of law, I think, is truly authoritarian. Chris Winan is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. His book, From the Palmer Raids to the Patriot Act, A History of the Fight for Free Speech in America. I do want to move into the present, but just I'm just so fascinated by your history here, and assuming that there's lots of people that probably don't even know the kind of suppression that existed, as you say, just a generation ago. Tell us about Banned in Boston. I know, for instance, in Detroit, there was a Detroit Police Film Board. And there was a couple of guys, my parents and my dad said, boy, I'd like to have his job. You got to see every film that ever was exhibited in Detroit, and they'd say, oh, no, who? We're not having that. You can't be, in your bathing suits on the beach and from here to eternity. They cut out that famous scene in that film, apparently. Tell us specifically about Boston, because you talk quite a bit about that, but also in general, the local censorship boards around the country.
Well, the fight in Boston was in the 1920s. It was just a few years after the founding of the ACLU. And in fact, the ACLU really didn't want to touch the fight with a 10-foot pole, because they were much more focused on political censorship, and they were afraid to get involved in a fight over, you know, seeming smut. Even though, as I said, under the Comstock law, the range of materials that could be suppressed was far, you know, greater than what we would call smut today. And in Boston, we had a situation where there was a growing movement in literature toward greater realism in the depiction of sexual activity, whether in the novels of D.H. Lawrence or, as you pointed out, in James Joyce's Ulysses, that ran smack into a bunch of local groups, anti-obscenity groups that fought back tooth and nail against them. And in Boston, it resulted in the suppression of, you know, 40 to 50 books over a, you know, 5-year, 6-year period, including some of the greatest authors in American literature. And there was Faulkner, there was Hemingway, there was the English people were Lawrence and the Irishman Joyce, of course, and there was a sustained fight in an effort to drive those books out of Boston, which gave Boston the reputation as being a very censorious town, even though, you know, 100 years before it had been this great intellectual capital of the country. And the fight was joined there, and ACLU, against its better instincts, was drawn into the fight, and important steps were taken, and ultimately the very broad Massachusetts obscenity law was narrowed somewhat, and kind of the symbol of the victory was the declaration by the United States government in 1933 that Ulysses was not obscene, was protected by the First Amendment. But these fights, as you point out, it went on in almost every community around the country, and there were film boards throughout the country. There was the Detroit police actually had a reputation in the 50s for being particularly hard on paperback books. They had their own Bureau of Review that told distributors what paperback books could be distributed in Detroit. And what these censors succeeded in doing was really removing from the American people the right to make their own choices about what they wanted to see, read, and hear. And the film industry was a particular target, because there was a great deal of concern about the masses and what the masses might be seeing on the big screen. And the film censors throughout the country did their own versions of films. You know, they applied the scissors themselves.
They were the editor.
In some cases, you know, they cut cut kisses out entirely or shortened them. They took out pictures of women nursing babies, even the most They took out pictures of women even knitting baby clothes because it suggested that, you know, something was going on inside that woman, which might give people ideas.
How did it get there? Yeah.
They took out depictions of municipal corruption because they thought, you know, people should respect their elected officials. They took out whatever they wanted to, really, and infantilized American, you know, a lot of American films, and forced the film industry to self-censor, something that continued in this country really until the 1960s. The code that the film industry imposed upon itself, and that excluded things like any depictions of homosexuality or even suggestions of homosexuality.
Chris Ryan, let's do this. I noticed by the clock we're getting close to the end, and we haven't gotten up to the present.
Okay.
My fault. To the Patriot Act, as you indicated earlier, under the presidency of Woodrow Wilson, a man was prosecuted for for uttering the words. Was it that Woodrow Wilson was a fathead? Was that
right?
Well,
right.
I mean, I'll say it right out. George W. Bush is a fathead. Nothing's going to happen to me.
No.
I don't think the Homeland Security is going to come gobble me up. The Patriot Act, I mean, there certainly has been a lot of challenges to it. But what in it is a problem for censorship or repression of expression?
Well, we're most concerned, booksellers, the people I work for, and librarians have devoted most of our attention to the portion of the Patriot Act which allows the government to get the records of what we read whenever they feel that they need them. Under the Patriot Act, it used to be that and in most contexts outside the national security context, the police feel that they need library records or bookstore records for some reason. They have to have probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed, and if they can't show probable cause, booksellers or librarians can challenge those subpoenas and have them suppressed. What the Patriot Act does is basically says anything the government wants in a national security investigation, it can have. And we believe that that is a threat, that has a chilling effect on people, you know, when they go into bookstores and libraries, and potentially prevents them from buying books that they don't want the government to know that they read.
Well, wouldn't people in response say, hey, look, we just had the head of Homeland Security says he has a, quote, feeling that there could be a terrorist attack. That this is not broad-based and not stopping the selling of books. Maybe in extraordinary times their little censorship isn't so bad.
Well, the question is what constitutes extraordinary times, and you know, extraordinary measures in a short period of time are one thing. Measures that could chill free speech, you know, for decades is something else, and has to be a lot more carefully considered. I mean, in general, we have given the government very broad powers of surveillance over us. At the same time that it is adopting an increasing amount of secrecy about itself. And in the past, that's been a bad combination. Because if we can't see what the government is doing, and we ourselves are afraid of that the government may be spying on us, abuses occur. And, you know, in the 50s and in the 60s, the FBI took it on itself to spy on what it considered to be America's enemies, communists, leaders of the civil rights movement, including Martin Luther King, leaders of the anti-war movement, the movement against the war in Vietnam. And not only did they spy on those critics of American policy, they actually sought to disrupt their political activity. So what we're trying to do in raising questions about the Patriot Act and the expansion of government powers is not to deprive the government of the power it needs to fight terrorism. Obviously, terrorism is a real threat. But what we're saying is that based on our historical experience, it's important to have safeguards.
Well, I agree completely. And actually, there's a number of great quotes on the back of your book. Anthony Lewis, former New York Times columnist and author of Gideon's Trumpet, says, American history is marred by recurrent episodes of hate, red scares, super patriotism, fear of sexual expression. Christopher Finan brilliantly paints that record and shows how courageous Americans have fought for freedom. And it's all contained in the book, lots more in there, obviously. From the Palmer Raids to the Patriot Act, a history of the fight for free speech in America. My guest has been Christopher M. Finan. You can see Chris's website at Chris Finan, FINAN.com. You can go to beacon.org. Beacon is the publisher. Also, a lot on my website will be links to this book, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Chris Finan, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Peter. It's been fun.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
So much time to sit down and think about. Most WRIF contests are open to legal U.S. residents at least 18 years old. Winners may win only one contest every 30 days or every 6 months for prizes worth $600 or more. Employees and their family of Greater Media Detroit, its advertising agencies, and other radio stations in the metro area may not participate. No purchase necessary. Prizes are not transferable, and rules are subject to change at any time. Complete rules are available online at WRIF.com or at the WRIF studios during regular business hours.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. I think most of you know of the man, Timothy Leary. Timothy Leary, he was the guru of LSD, the apostle of psychedelia. Richard Nixon called him the most dangerous man in America. And what a life this guy lived. And there's a brand new biography of him. It's written by John Higgs. And John Higgs has written for British publications, including The Guardian, Mojo, and The Independent. And he's created the long-running quiz show X Marks the Spot for BBC Radio 4. He's worked extensively in children's television and animation. He's produced a number of best-selling video games. He lives in Brighton, England. We're talking to him in England right now from Detroit. John Higgs, welcome to the Motor City.
Hi, Peter. Good to speak to you.
Well, thank you so much. Your book is I Have America Surrounded, The Life of Timothy Leary. For those few people, or I don't know, maybe we can't count since we have listeners, tell us maybe a little thumbnail sketch of what Timothy Leary is best known for. Of course, your book takes his whole life into consideration, but maybe his most popular media manifestation. What would that look like?
Oh, sure. Yeah, and certainly in the early 60s, Timothy Leary was a very well-respected psychologist studying at Harvard. And he was researching issues such as behavior change and very well respected for his books and things like that. Then he discovered or was introduced to psychedelic drugs, LSD, became convinced that this was the magic key that would create meaningful character change in people, and made it his life's ambition to persuade as many people as possible to take such drugs. I think we all know what happened next. The phrase tune in, turn on, drop out entered the national sort of lexicon. The hippies movement appeared, music changed forever, and things were never quite the same again.
Right, and Moody Blues had a song about him, incorrectly saying Timothy Leary is dead. No, what is it? What's the line in there? Timothy Leary is dead.
Timothy Leary's dead. Oh, no, he's outside looking in.
Oh, that's right.
But when he died, they re-recorded it so it was saying Timothy Leary lives.
And Timothy Leary lived from 1920 to just a little while ago, right?
Yeah, he died 10 years ago. The book was aimed to come out on the 10th anniversary of his death. It's always a good time to reevaluate people around that time, I always think. It's just long enough has gone past to be able to sort of get a clear glimpse of the impact they've had on life and things.
Well, John Higgs, there's been other biographies of Timothy Leary, yet you discovered some new documents. Tell us the story about that. It's a pretty interesting story in itself.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was writing for Mojo magazine. I don't know if you get that over here. It's an English classic rock magazine about an album Timothy Leary made with the German krautrock band Astral Temple when he was on the run and hiding in Switzerland. And there was an English painter and author called Brian Barrett who was very close to Leary at the time. And I was interviewing him about what had happened. And he just sort of scratched his head and goes, you know, I think I've got some of Penn's things somewhere. And he lives in a council flat in South London, and he just goes over to an old chest of drawers and rifled through it and came out with a few boxes of all Timothy Leary's diaries and letters. And of course, what had happened was Leary was captured in Afghanistan. And brought back to America.
He was a fugitive from, escaped from prison. We maybe can talk about that a little while later. So he was captured in Afghanistan, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So he left lots of things behind him for his 2 years on the run around the world. And this guy, Brian, had the forethought to sort of gather them up for posterity. They've just been sitting and looked at for about 30 years, so it was going to be a real piece of history, a real find. And then when I realized I wanted to write the book, I got in touch with his archivist, Michael Horowitz, and also the estate, and they had masses and masses of material. So I was able to go back to the original sources and find out exactly what happened, because there are many, many inaccurate tales told about Bleary, most of them told by himself, I think it's fair to say.
Well, you've told that sort of matter-of-factly, but it must have been an extraordinary experience to hear as this amazing cultural figure from the 20th century that some people say defined the 1960s, in at least its cultural aspect, and there you are holding material that has never been published before. Did you get that sense that you had...
I got a real shock, because I had one of his diaries in my hand, and it was just a small diary in 1972. Written on the front, and I just opened it up, and the first thing I read, I probably can't say the word, I just realized it was 2 weeks, 2 trips, 2 great, a sexual word I probably can't say on your radio show, and it was this sort of level of camping sort of material. It's a little snapshot straight into this life, and because the life was so unbelievable, so... all this stuff about him escaping from jail and going on the run to Algiers in Africa, and then being kidnapped by the Black Panthers and having to escape from them, and then escaping into Europe, and then being falling under the clutches of an exiled French arms dealer. It looks like the pages of a James Bond novel or something. Unbelievable. It's incredible to think that, a life is lived at that sort of level just 30 years ago.
Well, I think you may have whetted a lot of appetites. This is the whole story. We're talking with John Higgs. He's in Brighton, England, as we speak with him. He's written the book, I Have America Surrounded, The Life of Timothy Leary. You can go to IHaveAmericaSurrounded.com, right? Am I the right suffix?
That's the one.
IHaveAmericaSurrounded.com. It's published by Barricade Books. So some of these stories have certainly been told, but there are ones that, I was talking with somebody about it, and a lot of the life of Timothy Leary was kind of foggy. Now he and the man that became Ram Dass, they set up this little kind of psychedelic house, and their adversary was, who is now a right-wing talk show host, G. Gordon Liddy. Tell us that little bit of it.
In many ways, Leary was responsible for Liddy getting to the White House and Watergate and everything that happened because of that. He was, I can't remember the exact rank, but he worked for the local county police, and they just wanted Leary out. This is Millbrook in New York State, and they just wanted all these guys, they were academics and researchers, but they were clearly a strange bunch in this big old estate, running strange experiments, with having strange visitors. And so they raided the house, and there was, I suppose you would call it a harassment nowadays. Everyone going into the house is stopped and searched, and people ticketed for the most minor details, and for the person who owned the house had to set it up as enough and had to sort of a victim. And this gave Liddy the reputation as a drugs expert in law enforcement departments, and then he quickly moved the ranks and made it all to the White House and to the career he has now.
Now, why, I was looking at some of the other people that assessed him. The writer Hunter S. Thompson, on the back of your book, he says, Tim was a chieftain. He stomped on the terror and he left his elegant hoofprints on all our lives. But he also said that Timothy Leary was not just wrong, but a treacherous creep and a horrible goddamn person. What?
Absolutely. And in fact, was that quote from Hunter S. Thompson that really made me want to write the book, because that was when there was a lot of information released about Timothy's collaboration with the FBI when he was in jail, back in jail in the early 70s. And this was information that was known at the time, but it sort of reappeared in the late 90s and was presented as shocking news that this counterculture figure was, speaking to the FBI. And the whole context of the story had been lost. The whole and the details and the intricacies. And I figured if, you know, if, even if Huntress Thompson is judging him so strongly on this one thing, that it was probably a good time to try and sort of put the context back on Leary's life and sort of blow away a lot of the baggage and the misunderstandings and just try to present it sort of quite cleanly.
Well, maybe we should. I was going to say, maybe we should examine his legal problems. Now, LSD was legal up until, let me see here, October 6, 1966. So then it became an illegal drug. And how did Leary relate to the prohibition of the key element of his turn-on, tune-in, drop-out philosophy?
Yeah, up until LSD becoming illegal, people often forget that Leary was publicly, at least, almost respectable or understandable about how he talked about the drug. He would sort of advocated responsible use with guys, and he advocated something called set and setting, which sort of prevents bad trips, and was talking about it being the drug being legal and taxed, and being a proper system for Americans to be able to take the drug. But it was only when it was made illegal that he really started. It sort of raised the ante for him. He started taking his message directly to the youth of America, to the hippie movement that was just burgeoning around then. As soon as all of the avenues had been closed to him, he basically just went completely public. Up in, you know, media-friendly sound bites he could find, was appearing to all the right happenings and parties and gigs and things, and just telling everybody that they should take this very, very powerful psychedelic drug. Well, I mean, the figures vary, but a common one is 8 million Americans did so because of his advocacy.
Now, John Higgs, I'm sorry, go ahead, finish up.
Oh, no, sorry, Peter.
Okay. We're talking to John Higgs, and John Higgs, among other publications, has written for the rock magazine Mojo. And I suspect by looking at your photograph that you were present and during the height of the rave movement in England. And many people say that ecstasy that fueled a lot of the raves, pardon me, altered the character of English youth, almost a generation. I don't know how broad one can take that, but can you compare the impact of LSD in the 1960s and the impact of ecstasy in the 1980s and the 1990s, one in the U.S., one in England?
Oh, I mean, that's a difficult question. It certainly was a similar sort of size of impact. I mean, obviously, the thing in the 60s was the first of its kind, I guess. So there was a lot of lessons being learned as we went along. The ecstasy thing, unfortunately, at the time, I was very much into grunge, which I kind of regret now. I think I made the wrong musical choices about 15 years ago. So I missed a lot of the rave scene myself. But it's certainly the... It's interesting because the rave scene became a very political thing over here, because there was a piece of legislation called the Criminal Justice Bill that was designed to basically crush it out because it arose spontaneously and quite illegally on the outskirts of London. Huge parties of 5, 10, up to 20, I think it was a 50,000 person illegal rave just appearing spontaneously. No stars, no heroes, no. There's just a few anonymous DJs. It's just total communal, almost like a tribal thing. It's just a completely different way of living, and people saw it as a thing that was just so good and rewarding compared to the normal 9-to-5 rat race and the normal jobs like that. But yes, it became crushed, I think it's not too strong a word, by a piece of legislation called the Criminal Justice Bill, which made it illegal for, I think it was 10 people to gather and listen to music with repetitive beats or something like that. and so that politicized a lot of the counterculture over here, to an extent that led to a lot of the anti-globalization movement over here. It's all very much tied into that. The psychedelics in the 60s was a lot more, how would you describe it? it was just a break from everything that had gone before. A lot of people I spoke to said, look, the 1950s were in black and white. Well, you know, they were in black and white. That's how they saw them. Life changed so hugely for a lot of these people involved in the psychedelic scene at the time. It almost became a different world. But the rave thing was very much about a better world. And so, yeah, I guess the differences are something like that.
Well, I know the legendary surrounding of the Pentagon in 1967, and I can't remember whether it was Leary at that, where people actually did take LSD, and they said they were going to levitate the Pentagon. I don't remember.
Yeah, I think that was Abby Hoffman.
Yeah, it was Abby Hoffman and the Yippies, but I don't know.
Yeah,
go ahead.
And very much... That was always the thing that sort of turned off the 60s and the hippies as growing up. So I heard that story quite early, and it just struck me as so naive that all these people tried to levitate the Pentagon. It's such a ludicrous thing that they could actually believe in.
Oh, ye of little faith.
But since I've learned more about it, I understand sort of the humor of the thing and how it was just part of a larger sort of... movement and things like that. So now I find it very funny, I have to say.
Well, John Higgs, it was my fault, but I kind of interrupted the story of Leary's legal problem. So LSD is made illegal in 1966, yet the drug bust that tripped Leary up and led him to essentially becoming an informant for the FBI and other law enforcement groups wasn't LSD, as you relate in your book, I Have America Surrounded, the life of Timothy Leary, but marijuana. So maybe pick it up from there.
Yeah, and a very small amount of marijuana as well. He had two busts, were both finding a few flakes or a couple of roaches in a car that didn't belong to him that he happened to be in. And because of that, he was sentenced to up to 20 years, which for a man who was 50 years old is a life sentence in all but name. There's no doubt it was a political thing. There's no doubt that... the Nixon government wanted Leary off the streets. They wanted to lock him up, and they knew that a lot of the sort of mainstream America wanted that as well. Nixon went to the extent of calling Leary the most dangerous man in America, which is where the title of my book comes from. In one of his last interviews, he was asked about this, and he just deadpanned in this. In this perfectly serious voice, yes, I have America surrounded, which took me so funny.
Sure.
It's the classic Leary gag that I had to use it as the title. He was his wife and his son and in one arrest and his daughter in another bust were also charged with possession of marijuana. And so he kind of had to plead guilty to get them off him. It was made very clear to him that it was him he was after. And in 1970, he was sent to jail.
And there he was in Northern California, right? But in one of America's most famous jail breaks, to pick it up there, if you would.
Well, I mean, it's so funny. When he was jailed, he went for the mandatory psychological tests, which all prisoners go through when they decide where they're going to send the prisoner. And for as many years as Leary had to serve, 20 years, he would normally be sent to a high-security prison because the long sentence equals escape risk. But he was given these tests. And he looked at them, and he realized that he'd invented most of them in about 14 years earlier in the 1950s when he was one of the most respected behavioral psychologists in America. So he knew what every question was testing, what every answer would reveal. So he filled out the forms in such a way that would make him look the most docile and meek individual it was possible to appear. And so when the decision to which prison to send him to was made, these forms said that Timothy Leary was in no way an escape risk, despite what anybody who'd read the papers over the previous decade might have thought. And so he was sent to a low-security prison in San Luis Obispo. A few months later, he was over the wire, climbed onto the top of the cell block and got across the wire on a telephone pole. and the weather underground got him out of America. And 2 weeks later, he surfaced in Algiers with the Black Panthers.
Now, so this is this incredible situation. Timothy Leary is in jail. The weather underground breaks him out. He's there's this, somehow they're able to get him to Algiers, where Eldridge Cleaver, the fugitive Black Panther, is. This is extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, the great hope was that he was seen as the leader of the white counterculture, and Cleaver was seen as the leader of the Black counterculture, and there's a lot of hope that Cleaver and Leary would work together and sort of unite the movement and so forth.
But he ran afoul of Cleaver.
He what, sorry, Peter?
That what?
I didn't catch it.
Oh, I'm sorry. He ran afoul of Eldridge Cleaver, and there was a break there, right?
Yeah, I mean, Cleaver and Leary had absolutely nothing in common. It's probably the easiest way to look at it. And it also became a bit, sort of looking after Leary was a lot of heat, a lot of pressure for Cleaver, when there was all sorts of, the Black Panther Party in particular was a lot of, the CIA's, I can't remember the name of the program. COINTELPRO.
COINTELPRO, yeah.
Yeah, the COINTELPRO were really working on the Black Panther Party, trying to sort of create divisions and force splits and things, and let the party sort of turn on itself and attack itself, which was working very, very successfully. And so the last thing that Cleaver needed was someone like Timothy Leary, with all the, you know, the most wanted man in America, with all the attention he was getting on his patch. And he kidnapped him. He kidnapped him and his wife, Rosemary. And they were taken out of their apartment building and driven and locked up in safe houses for the best part of a week, with no idea if anybody knew they'd been kidnapped or, whether there was any attempt to, save them or anything like that. Much, much scarier than being in the jails in America, where obviously, you know, due legal process and things like this. I had no idea at all what was going to happen. But they managed to get out of that by getting, they were sort of allowed to release, but they had to give them their passports, which they managed to trick another Panther to get their passports back, which led them to sort of flee Algeria.
Well, let me do this. We're quickly running out of time. This is an extraordinary story, and it's well chronicled in John Higgs's book, I Have America Surrounded, The Life of Timothy Leary. But let me bring this part to a conclusion by saying that Leary winds up in Switzerland. He is finally apprehended by the American authorities in Afghanistan. He's brought back to the United States. He's facing, as we said earlier, 20 years in jail. And then he begins, in the parlance at the time, narking, ratting out his old pals, right, as a way to gain favor.
Yeah, well, I say absolutely. It's not a very black and white situation. I mean, he certainly was talking to the FBI, and he certainly was trying to cooperate with them to the extent that would get him released earlier. But, I mean, it's well known that he spent 2 years talking to them, and, you know, no one was jailed or arrested for anything he said. The main reason being because he didn't know a lot of the things that they thought he knew. They wanted to bust the Hood of Eternal Love, which was a big drugs gang, and they wanted to get the weather underground. And Leary had been on the run for the past 2 years, and a little bit out of the loop, of course.
All right, let's do this. I was just going to say, I'm just looking at this clock, and this story is so fantastic. That's why you have to go get the book, I Have America Surrounded, The Life of Timothy Leary. But just a couple things in here. Finally, he is pardoned in 1976 by Governor Jerry Brown, and reinvents himself again, lives another 20 years. When he dies, his body is cremated, and their ashes are sent around the world. And you, John Higgs, they sent you some ashes. What was the occasion of that?
Oh, that was such a shock. I have to, the woman who runs the archive was a lovely, lovely woman called Dennis Berry, who helped me out so much, who went to the States, sorry. And I'd spent about 10 days or so in what's essentially a big lock-up in the Santa Cruz mountains where all his life's possessions are stored, got all his papers. And the very last day, when I was giving the keys and things back, she goes, oh, did you look in this one box? And, you know, there's about 300 boxes in this place, and that one that I'd missed. And I don't know what's in there. And she goes, oh, Tim's in there.
Oh, wow.
And she pulled out this cigar box with the remains of the ashes in there. And a very small pinch, as you say, had gone into space, and little pinches had gone to many, many of his friends. But she was so kind enough to send me one. And we scattered it here in England on Glastonbury tour. And on the night we were doing that, I met people who said, oh, yes, I was in Mexico, and I met some guys from MAPS, which is a psychedelic study organization, and they were burying a portion of Leary's ashes under a pyramid.
Well, I think the most interesting part of it, a small amount was shot into orbit along with the remains of Star Trek's Gene Roddenberry. You know, there's so much more here. I wanted to ask you the story about Winona Ryder, who wrote the foreword to this. No time for that. The only way to do it, get this incredible book, wonderful photographs as well. I have America Surrounded, The Life of Timothy Leary. It's published by Barricade, and the website is ihaveamericasurrounded.com. And John Higgs, thanks so much for joining us from Brighton, England. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Oh, pleasure was all mine, Peter.
This is WRIM.com.